11:30 having arrived, I'm going to call the Committee on Taxes to order. And members, if you would check your updated agenda, we have switched those bills. So we're going to be hearing the House File 2414 first, which is the Omnibus Health and Human Services Finance Bill. Then House File 1555 is second, the Omnibus Transportation Finance Bill. And we do have a quorum, and we do have some minutes. So we've got the minutes of April 10th, 2019 to approve. Representative Les Lagarde moves approval of the April 10th, 2019 minutes. Any discussion on those? If not, I'm going to call for the vote. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. The April 10th, 2019 minutes are approved. Motion prevails. All right. The first bill is House File 2414. So through a motion, I will move House File 2414 be referred to the General Register. Thank you, Representative Chair Liebling.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members, for hearing this bill. I know you have the bill actually in front of you. It is a pretty large bill, but actually the provisions that are in front of this committee don't take up that many pages, I should say. I was going to say they're not that large. They are large, but they're not taking up that many pages in the bill. I'd like to give you just a very brief overview, a little context for what the tax provisions are. As you know, we've got the repeal of the sunset on the provider tax, and we also have a health insurance premium tax credit that are before this committee. These provisions are part of the governor's One Care proposal. So, as members probably know, about 155,000 people, Minnesotans, buy their insurance in the individual health care market. And for many of these Minnesotans, the ones who do not have, the ones who are above 400% of the federal poverty level, affordability is a really serious issue because premiums are very, very expensive and out-of-pockets are very expensive. And I know that every member has heard from their constituents that insurance is really unaffordable for many, many people in this area. So part of the governor's package is what we would call the affordability provisions. So he's got what is not before this committee is a 20% discount on premiums that comes right off the top for everyone in this area who buys their insurance through MNsure would get a 20% discount off the top. But then there is this provision that is before this committee for a premium tax credit to essentially extend the federal premium tax credit to people above that 400% level so that everyone would be limited in how much they would have to pay for their health insurance premiums to about 9.8% of their income. So this would make buying health insurance more affordable, essentially for everyone who's in that market. I'll stop on that provision. But the other parts of the governor's package, which are not before this committee, but just for context, we have the 20% discount, the state-based premium tax credit, and then we have a couple of benefit packages that are right now more for our public programs, but that create a single pool for dental care and a single pool for prescription drugs. And those two pieces are not before this committee, but just for context, they are part of the governor's One Care proposal. And then finally, the governor has a platinum insurance product that comes online in 2023 that would provide a better health insurance option that would help people be able to buy an insurance product that has lower out-of-pockets and actually covers more of their health care needs. So that's the context. So I've mentioned the health insurance premium tax credit. Of course, one of the probably the most important piece that's before the committee today is the repeal of the sunset of the 2% provider tax. And Members have probably heard me say this before. I believe that the provider tax, the funding of the Healthcare Access Fund, which is what this tax has helped to fund, the Healthcare Access Fund is one of Minnesota's premier advantages when it comes to health care and health. It not only provides health care for, the estimate is about 200,000 Minnesotans, it supports the health care of over a million Minnesotans, 1.2 million approximately, who are on our public programs now. But it also supports health improvement options for every Minnesotan. And I think also very importantly, it provides absolutely critical flexibility for Minnesota to continue improving both the health of our population and the health care that is available to our population. So I view this as absolutely critical to our state. And so with that, I'm going to stop talking and let Commissioner Bowerly say a few words. She can give you more of the details of the proposals that are before this committee. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much, Representative Liebling. And members, there is this sheet right here that kind of has some of the tax items on it, just the few items that we're going. So it's on a 8.5 by 14 sheet of paper. So it's got 2019 session proposal tracking, and then to the very upper right, House File 2414 tax item. So that might give you the numbers and so forth. So it shows that the health insurance premium tax credit would be a cost, is that part, in 20 and 21 of $44.6 million, and for 22 and 23, $257.2 million. And then it's got information on the amount also for the provider tax. So, members, if it's all right, I'd actually like to go to maybe all the testifiers before we went to questions and or amendments. And we'll start, if that'd be okay, we'll do that. Commissioner Bowerly, welcome. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. My name is Cynthia Bowerly. I'm the Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Revenue. I want to thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, and Chair Liebling for the opportunity to provide some testimony about the bill before you today. The governor and lieutenant governor, when they proposed their budget, was founded on three of the most pressing areas for Minnesotans. One of those was health care, of course. And so the provider tax, of course, is critical to that, making sure that Minnesotans have access to high-quality health care. There are many pieces that must be put in place in order to provide a comprehensive solution to health and health care access across the state of Minnesota. And these key provisions are carried before you in House File 2414, the HHS Omnibus Bill. A couple of the main pieces of the governor's plan are maintaining the health care access fund with the sunset of the repealing the sunset of the provider tax to ensure continued access to lower cost health care for insurance to farmers, small businesses, owners, entrepreneurs. And by maintaining individual insurance market stability through the premium subsidy and the state-based health insurance tax credit. And then finally, the additional care and packages that are a part of the governor's One Care proposal. I will focus my testimony this morning on the tax items with the state-based health insurance tax credit and the provider tax. The Healthcare Access Fund, as I think you know, and was created in 1992 in Minnesota to improve the health of Minnesotans through prevention and by expanding access to health care, contain health care costs, and improve the quality and affordability of health care services for Minnesotans. So it was a very long time ago that this state decided to make these investments in people's health across the state. Access to care is improved through payment and subsidies through insurance, both Minnesota Care and medical assistance, ensuring that people can get to preventative care and take care of their health needs before they can become a crisis or urgent and then wind up in emergency rooms. And through grants and programs that directly support the provider system, especially rural and safety net providers and those providing care to underserved populations. The Minnesota Care program alone provides health care coverage for more than 83,000 Minnesotans across the state who earn too much to qualify for Medicaid, but whose incomes are below the 200% of the federal poverty line, and they don't have access to otherwise to insurance provided by their employer. Access to care for all of those in insurance, for all insurance markets, is supported by statewide prevention and the state's capacity to track and analyze trends in healthcare spending. The provider tax generates about 80% of the revenue for the Healthcare Access Fund and is the reason for its stability and the ability to keep pace with the costs of care and other programs provided by the Healthcare Access Fund. In addition to those two primary programs, Minnesota Care and Medical Assistance, since its inception, the provider tax has funded the Minnesota Department of Health's Office of Rural Health and Primary Care, and policy analysis used by the legislature, researchers, and others through the Health Economics Program. Expanding the quality improvement and prevention efforts, including the Statewide Health Improvement Partnership, or SHIP, were significant components of the last time we took a look at the comprehensive healthcare reform in Minnesota, passed with strong bipartisan support in Governor Pawlenty's second term in 2008. SHIP is the only statewide system to offer effort to reduce the top three risk factors driving the majority of chronic diseases, which collectively account for about 80% of all healthcare spending. The revenues for the healthcare Access Fund come from several sources, but primarily from the 2% health tax on healthcare providers. We need to repeal the sunset provision in the provider tax to maintain these essential health programs for thousands of Minnesotans. The provider tax is levied from patient services at hospitals, surgical centers, and healthcare providers. It also applies to the gross revenues of wholesale drug distributors, as well as on amounts paid for prescription drugs by entities subject to the Legend Drug Use Tax. There are a couple of more technical provisions related to the provider tax in this bill, Mr. Chair and members, that relate to Wayfair changes. You're familiar that the United States Supreme Court decision in Wayfair versus South Dakota ensured that the state could extend its authority to remote sellers. There are a couple of provisions that have the provider tax for wholesale drug distributors and Legend drug distributors that need to be updated to accommodate the changes the Supreme Court announced in the Wayfair decision last year. We want to ensure that there is fairness for remote sellers located outside of the state to collect items on the same items that they would have to pay the tax on if they were selling from a store in Minnesota. Under those technical changes, the taxpayers who have nexus under those provisions now have the obligation to also collect and remit the provider tax. I'd like to take a moment to describe the state-based health insurance tax credit, which is a key element of the individual market stabilization package that is in the governor's program. As Chair Liebling mentioned, one component is a subsidy that is a 20% subsidy program designed to replicate the 20% discount for Minnesota consumers who purchase their own insurance on the exchange. The state-based health insurance tax credit is available for Minnesotans whose annual income is in excess of 400% of the federal poverty guidelines. These individuals do not qualify for the federal assistance when they enroll in qualified health plans through the exchange. These Minnesotans pay full premiums for health insurance coverage. For 2019, 400% of the federal poverty guidelines for an individual was $49,000, and for a family of four, it was $103,000. These Minnesotans pay full premiums for health insurance coverage when purchased on the exchange. Starting in plan year 2021, state-based health insurance tax credit would be available for households and individuals with an annual income that meets those guidelines, and the credit would ensure that they pay no more than 10% of their income on health insurance premiums. The credit is based on the cost of the benchmark plan in an individual rating area and tied to the federal benchmark affordability percentage, which currently is 9.86%. So just a couple of examples, members. A 61-year-old individual living in St. Cloud with an income of $55,000 who enrolled in a silver plan would have a monthly premium of $693. They would receive a tax credit of $316, reducing their monthly premium to $377. A couple in Anoka with an income of $75,000 who enroll in a bronze plan with a monthly premium of $1,021 would receive a credit of $593, reducing their monthly premium to $428. The state-based credit can be paid in advance when the household enrolls in coverage, and so that can reduce the amount that they are paying directly each month, or they could choose to claim that on their income tax return as a refundable credit. In either case, the department will review as a part of their individual income tax return to make sure that the right amount of the credit was paid to those individuals based on their actual income for that year. We may pay an additional refund, or we may collect additional tax if the payment received was too large or too small. Over 45,000 Minnesotans are expected to qualify for the credit by 2023. This includes over 34,000 Minnesotans already in the individual market and over 13,000 uninsured Minnesotans who would join the individual market as a result of this new opportunity. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. We appreciate the time to share information about the new tax credit and its benefit to Minnesotans and the vital importance of extending the provider tax to fund essential services for so many Minnesotans. And we thank you, Mr. Chair, for hearing the bill, and we thank Chair Liebling for including so many of these of the governor's provisions in this bill that is moving forward.
Thank you, Commissioner Bowerly. Questions, members? Chair Davids.
Thank you, Chair Marquardt. Maybe for staff here, I'm a little confused on the credit, because normally tax credits are carried in the tax bill, not in any other bill. So my question would be, when do people get the credit, and how do they get the credit? I'm not concerned that if they have more coming that they get that, but if you got to claw back money, that could be a very substantial amount. I'm concerned about that part, but to staff, when do they receive the credit? Who gets the credit? And how do they receive it? Normally, on a credit, you get it on, you file your taxes, there's a tax attorney, get the credit. How is this credit paid?
Mr. Klayman?
Mr. Chair, Representative Davids, how the credit would work under this bill is that a taxpayer could elect to either take that as a refund in the manner that you described that would be typical for collecting a refund, or they can apply for an advance credit. If the taxpayer applies for an advance credit, then the amount of the tax credit would be transferred to MNsure, and MNsure would then distribute that to the insurance company that the taxpayer is using.
Well, so, Mr. Chairman, so what we're doing, we're writing checks to insurance companies through this program. Is that, or Mr. Klayman, or Mr. Chair, is that correct, Mr. Klayman?
Maybe Chair Liebling would like to answer that, or Commissioner.
Well, yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I would say that, you know, I mean, people know that this is not, in my world, this would not be the ideal way to go. But, in fact, this is very different than what reinsurance is doing. Reinsurance is paying insurance companies directly, and the consumer never, or through MCHA, but regardless, the money is going right to the insurance company. The consumer is not in there, is not seeing it, is not understanding what is being done on their behalf. In this proposal, yeah, there is eventually a settle up with the insurance companies. However, the consumer would see the discount coming to them, and the consumer would see the tax credit on their return, is how I understand it. Maybe Commissioner Bowerly would like to speak to it as well.
Commissioner Bowerly, would you like to add to that?
Sure. Chair Marquardt and Chair Davids, you're correct. It would be if the individual chooses to have an advance payment, then it would be applied directly through their enrollment process. And if they choose to have it as a refundable credit, they would apply for that credit on their individual income tax returns. Under either of those scenarios, the department will work with the exchange to ensure we have the correct information, because when you enroll for health insurance, right, it is a year prior to the tax year that we would be accounted for, and we would ensure that the individual or family receives the right amount based on their income for that year and the right amount of credit that they would be entitled to.
Chair Davis.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, to Commissioner Bowerly, well, first of all, reinsurance that we have now does not pay money to insurance companies. It's a reinsurance pool that if an insurance company has a shock loss, then they get it, but they're not writing checks to an insurance company. If an insurance company has no shock losses, they get no checks. This myth about money going directly to insurance companies for reinsurance is B as in B, S as in S. Okay, now my question is, who's writing these checks to the insurance companies? And where's the money coming from?
Commissioner Bowerly.
Chair Mark Gordon, Chair Davids, the money is coming from the Healthcare Access Fund to help stabilize the market. It is going through the exchange to the insurance companies that are offering those plans on the exchange and the individuals who are rolling in the exchange.
Chair Davids.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, members, we have government writing checks directly to insurance companies. I thought that was the big thing that why reinsurance was so bad, even though it was outright lies. They were being told about what happens with the reinsurance program. Outright lies. No, I can't say lies. The truth is exactly contrary to what has been said. So now we go from a program where an insurance company could get nothing to a program where government is writing checks directly to insurance companies. What am I missing here? Nothing. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A point of clarification, I hear with regards to this individual market and the premium subsidy and the individual market stabilization plan, about the exchange and the money that's going to be available to individuals, what about a lot of my friends and neighbors who are small business owners, farmers, and so forth, who don't want to use the MNsure exchange? They want to use their small town agents, because when they have a question about benefits and so forth, are those folks also going to be eligible for this 20% premium subsidy, or is it forced on folks only, or is it available to folks only if they use the exchange?
Commissioner Bowerly.
Chair Markwart and Representative Fabian, it is available for those who use the exchange.
Representative Fabian.
So to clarify, you're shutting out my friends and neighbors and many people who choose to use their local agent to purchase their insurance there instead of on the exchange. Is that what you're saying?
Chair Markwart and Representative Fabian, I think shutting out is people have the choice to use the exchange. There are benefits that are available on the exchange because that is how we can make sure that we are providing this benefit to them. The subsidy, the premium subsidy of 20% and the tax credit of that is available to ensure that it is that your premiums are 10% or less of your income are available on the exchange.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes or no? Are my small town agents and their customers going to be able to get this 20% credit?
Not unless they use the exchange.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that. So you said that using the exchange is the only way that you can make sure that they are doing this. So you don't trust our small town agents and my residents to be honest with government and file some sort of other return or some sort of a claim?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Fabian, I that is absolutely not what I said. I have no reason to mistrust anyone who files their taxes. We work with millions of taxpayers every single year.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Chair Liebling, why would you eliminate the ability of my small town agents and many agents all around the state from being able to use this program?
Mr. Chair.
Chair Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Fabian. My understanding is there are about 1,000 small town agents who are, in fact, MNsure navigators who are working very well with MNsure. So there may be some who choose not to, but I don't think that this is leaving them out at all. And just to be clear, right now, if you're under 400% of the federal poverty level but still have enough income that you don't get onto our public programs, and you are buying in the individual market, you don't get this. You don't get the federal tax credit unless you go through MNsure. Mm-hmm. So that's already in place, and it has to do with how we're able to calculate how much a person should be able to receive. It's simply a matter of practicality. It's not a matter of preferring anybody. But this is how it is now, and so the program here really just expands on that, and it's not dissing anybody. It's simply this is the mechanism that we have for making sure that we can determine eligibility and make sure that this money goes to who it's supposed to go to.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Excuse me. I'm sorry. I just find this all very disturbing. I can't imagine why you wouldn't make this available to some people that choose not to use the exchange. I just am really troubled by this.
Representative,
I hope that we can make some changes.
I'm sorry. Very good. Representative Joaquin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you. You've described all this pretty well. I'm not on HHS. I don't know if many of us on this committee are, and I haven't had enough coffee this morning, so I just want to clarify so I'm sure I understand. So this is functioning just like the federal credit, where if you don't go through an exchange, you don't get it. Is that accurate?
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Joaquin. In that respect, it is. Yeah, I think there are some other differences that the commissioner could speak to, but in that respect, yes.
And Mr. Chair?
Representative Joaquin.
And from what I understand, too, is that local insurance agents or brokers can choose to be a navigator and be part of the system so they're not frozen out right now and they wouldn't be under this bill.
Representative
Mr. Chair, Representative Joaquin, that's my understanding, yes.
And one more quick follow-up, just so I'm getting this right. So currently under reinsurance, any insurance company that had a claim between $50,000 and $250,000 could get a check regardless of who the claimant was, regardless of their income level. It was just kind of this blank check in hopes of, without any parameters on that, they'd actually lower the premiums, where this system is more, I guess you'd call it a pay-as-you-go. We're only shelling out the money if the individual qualifies for the credit and if they claim the credit. Is that accurate?
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Joaquin, I think that's accurate.
I think that's pretty fiscally responsible. Thank you.
Representative Blockler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And the information has since come up that, yes, brokers qualify. I've met with a broker in my district who's very happy helping people compare their options. The advantage of the MNsurance Exchange is it actually gives you comparable apples to apples ability to understand the difference between the programs and the different policies that are available to you. But I do know that some brokers, at least in my area, are finding it a very useful tool and are using it regularly.
Chair Davis.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple things here. Another part of the bill. Well, first of all, people are saying, I'm saying, hey, if you continue the sick tax, that's a tax increase. And they say, no, it's not a tax increase. Well, it'd be kind of like, let's say I had a house loan. Let's say I had a 30-year mortgage. I signed the papers. I agreed to the 30-year mortgage. I pay it off. My banker comes to me and says, oh, by the way, we want to continue that mortgage on you. Well, that's an increase to me. That's an increase. So let's not say it's not an increase. It is, because it's going away. Governor Dayton signed the bill in 2011 saying this thing goes bye-bye way into the future, into 2019. Well, now 2019's here. And so where I come from, a deal's a deal, and we're breaking that deal. But we seem to be doing that quite a bit here lately. So my good friend on the other side of the aisle was mentioning that under reinsurance, there's no checks to reduce premiums. It doesn't have to go to reduce premiums. There's not in this either. There's nothing that says premiums need to go down because we're giving money to these funds if you go through the exchange, and a lot of folks don't get it. So there's no criteria now to lower premiums, none. Now, maybe staff could describe to me what happens here with the savior to many people called short-term major medical. What does this bill do with short-term major medical?
Mr. Chair, yeah. Representative Davids, I believe that the only insurance plans that this particular, so the advanced tax credit would cover, would be those that are available on the MNsure exchange, so I'm not sure if those would be covered by.
Well, thank you, Mr. Clayman.
Yeah, Chair Davids, I don't know if that's necessarily. No. We might not know that in the tax realm here, but
premium tax effect. You got to pay a premium tax on it. So, from what I understand, the short-term major medical issue that pays a premium tax is limited. Okay. Now, I'm working with two folks right now. One of them's a big supporter of MNsure and the Affordable Care Act, and they have messed it up so bad that they contacted him last week and says he doesn't have any coverage. And I said, well, you better get some short-term major medical on that to get you to the 1st of January. That's the only thing that's going to save you. It doesn't cover pre-existing conditions, but you have a massive heart attack or stroke or a car accident or something like that. In a car accident, you got your PIP coverage first, but that $20,000 is used up in about 5 minutes. And so there, it's a very, very valuable policy to get people through to January 1st, since before all of this, you could buy a health insurance policy any day of the week. Now you can't. You have people that come in. MinSure messed up, the biggest failure of all time, MinSure. You go into MinSure, they mess it up, and I'd like to give you names, but I don't have permission at this time. And so my comment to my client, who was big on Obamacare and thing, I said, how are you liking it now? He says, well, not so much. So the short-term major medical, we're going to have to make sure that we don't do anything to mess that up, because that's a very, very valuable thing, basically clean up the messes of MinSure to get people to January 1st of the next year. Very, very valuable to do that. So just to review a couple things, there's no premium checks to reduce premiums on what's going on here. Yeah, it'll reduce premiums, but so does reinsurance. But there's no guarantees that the insurance companies under this plan, under this scheme, are going to do anything either. So a couple things to look at. I'll be following up on the short-term issue. And to say that continuing the sick tax is not a massive regressive tax increase on the poor is just not true. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Schumacher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And first question for the discussion on this bill. I'm just wondering, with this, the proposal that we've been talking about currently here and the fiscal responsibility of being able to limit the people who get reductions in their health insurance based on if they go through the exchange or not, in order to trust the people who are filing these, we're going to have more people processing these. How many FTEs are going to be in this fiscally responsible proposal that is in front of us?
Commissioner Bowerly.
Mr. Chair, Representative Schumacher, if you give me one moment, I can take a look at that.
Commissioner?
So, Mr. Chairman and Representative Schumacher, there are, as you would see in the, if you looked at the governor's change page on this item, there is a breakdown of the costs related to the state-based premium tax credit. There are costs for administering this both at MinSure and at the Department of Revenue. We would need to make sure that we have the data about the enrollment information so that we could work with taxpayers when they file for that tax credit to on their individual income tax return to make sure that we can get them the right amount of the credit that they're due based on their actual income for that tax year.
Representative Schumacher.
Sorry, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Commissioner. What was the FTE number for that?
The total FTE number is about 40. As a startup, and then as the program is established, it reduces to about a little over 30.
Very good. Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to thank Chair Liebling for bringing forward a really excellent Health and Human Services omnibus bill. And I just want to address a few comments that were made. One, we do have in the bill a premium discount of 20% that would reduce premiums, and consumers would know that. They would see the reduction immediately when they went to sign up. Second, MinSure is a website where people go and shop and compare plan products. And so I'm really tired of everyone beating up on a website that functions to help people shop for their health insurance. And so I think there are a lot of good options here to reduce premiums and affecting many people who right now get no help at all in reducing their premium. They're paying the full price. They get no tax discount through an employer, and this bill will really help address individuals I'm hearing from in my district that get no premium relief whatsoever. This is going to help many, many, many people in my district and yours as well that will get some premium relief. So thanks again, Chair Liebling, for bringing this forward.
All right.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I may have been distracted, but I'm wondering, on the 40 FTEs, what's the fiscal note on the 40 FTEs?
Commissioner Bowerly. And I don't know if that's that line 1096 that we're looking at where it says MNsure Administration or... Ms. Templin, would you? Ms. Templin may have that information too. So,
Ms. Templin says the answer is yes, and if she says the answer is yes, we all know the answer is
okay.
Yes.
Well,
I'm sorry, I didn't have the spreadsheet in front of me, but your spreadsheet is carried.
Commissioner Bowerly, so what is the answer to that?
The answer, I believe, is that it is on line 1096 for the MNsure admin, and sorry, on my glasses, 1095 for the Department of Revenue Administration.
Very good. So, Representative Fabian, it's off of that sheet again. There's a 1095 line and a 1096 line that refers to DOR administration and MNsure administration.
So, Mr. Representative Chair, I just want to be sure I'm clear here, and Ms. Templin can help me. We're looking at 500 and what would that be? 5,780,000?
Correct. That looks like for 2021, yeah.
Okay. So that, Mr. Chair,
Representative Fabian.
So does the 40 FTEs is covered by the 5,780,000?
Commissioner Bowerly.
So, Mr. Chairman and Representative Fabian, so the line 1095 is the Department of Revenue Administration, and the Department of Revenue's administration is about 11 FTEs in 22 and 10 FTE in 2023. And then the line 1096, that is the MNsure administration, and that is the 40 FTE that I mentioned. And the 30 and that starts in 2021.
So what's the Representative Fabian?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So can you add those totals up for me quickly?
The FTE totals?
The dollar amount totals.
Well, so as fast as I could. Well,
it looks like the totals for 2021 would be the 5.78 million.
Yep.
And it looks like, well, here, we've got. Commissioner?
It's my understanding it's about 6.3 for 22 for all 4 years. Thank you.
Okay, so, Commissioner, what was that number for all 4 years?
I believe it's 6.3.
Okay, about 6.3 million for those 4 years.
So,
Representative Fabian.
Okay, so these 40 FTEs, are these the ones who are going to be writing checks out to the insurance companies?
Commissioner Bowerly, what will they be doing?
Mr. Chair and Representative Fabian, so these individuals at MNsure will help ensure that individuals are, as they're navigating into the system, understand what their plans are available to them. They will send them the shopping tool will need to be updated, so the system will need to be updated to ensure that customers will see the actual price they would pay with the addition of the credit. They will provide notice to the consumers confirming the amount of the tax credit that is applied to their selected plan. They will assist consumers with changing income or other eligible criteria during the year, because when you enroll, you if you get a raise or you have a change to your income during the year, then your amount for the credit would change. They would provide an end-of-the-year file to the Department of Revenue, and that's where the Department of Revenue's role comes in. We will update the tax system and the forms to ensure that people can claim the credit, and then we will work to reconcile that as a part of the tax filing, the existing tax filing system.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I think we need to keep looking at this because I'm still not clear. I mean, I'm doing a little math, and I come up with numbers between $37,000 a year and $144,000 a year, depending upon which numbers I'm plugging in. for the compensation for those employees to, and I just, I don't know. You know, when you look at, what is it, 1,130 pages of a bill, it's hard for me to get my arms around it. Well, I don't mean that literally, but it's concerning to me that we're going to grow government so that we can write checks out to the insurance companies, which I was told in the previous 2 years was not a good thing to do. So, thank you.
Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Berg just, you know, used his little calculator to give us the real number. So what we're adding here in terms of additional personnel, it's so if you add the $5,780,000 that is on the MNsure line for 2021, and then you add the what's on the 2223 number for the Department of Revenue, you get $7,697,000, which is the total for the FTEs over the four-year period. So the number we were working on wasn't quite accurate there.
And that's what I see, about $7.7 million over
exactly.
Those 4 years. All right, Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to clarify that some of these FTEs, many are going to be manning the call center so people can get help, assistance, enrolling, and not have to have long wait times on the call to get that assistance. And that means that many of them will be temporary, that they're going to be there to man the enrollment period and then will no longer be needed. So we really need to look at, you can't just divide the FTEs by this total amount, because many of them who man the call center won't be permanent employees.
Yeah. And Mr. Chair.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to make sure everyone understands that's not just paying for the people. It's also paying for the system update that would be necessary. So I just want to be sure that that's clear. That's the total additional number.
Very good. So, Representative Schultz, anything else? Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So can we get a breakdown on the FTE cost and then also the system upgrade cost? Because when I just did the numbers here real quick again, the $7.7 million divided by 40 FTEs, because we're talking about full-time equivalents, whether they're part-time workers or full-time workers, we're talking about full-time equivalents, and that comes out to a compensation number, and again, as we've said before, I'm a FIED teacher, not a math teacher. But for me, that's $48,700 a year. And I'm quite sure that the compensation numbers that we have for state employees is much higher than that. But
yeah. Is there a breakdown, either Commissioner Bowerly or Representative Liebling, on the system upgrade versus personnel? Did anyone happen to have that, Commissioner?
Sure, Marquardt. And Representative Fabian, one thing I would note that we provided you with a four-year number.
Okay.
So that includes both system costs and FTE costs, but there are 40 FTE per year. So I think the math is not just to divide the total four-year cost with the annual FTE number. A little bit of that is that. I am trying to make sure, before I give you a number, that I understand which of these expenditures are systems.
You know, and we could come back to this after taking more. Would that be all right, Representative Fabian?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I'd like actually some more detail on the system upgrades.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
We've had a few glitches in our systems here in the state of Minnesota, and I'm skeptical.
So let's see if we can get those, and we'll continue on here. If we get these before we're done here, we'll provide that. So Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to that point, since we're gathering a little bit more information, just wondering on the backside, the program that the counties use has never worked very well, and my counties are incredibly frustrated with that, the METS program on the backside. Wondering if this change is going to do anything to help counties navigate through and actually perform their duties correctly and cut down on some of their burden and their time and their frustrations. Is there any money in there to accommodate the counties on the side they have to use?
Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative O'Neill. There is some other money in the budget to keep working on that, but it's really separate because I think what you're referencing is eligibility for public programs. That's been so when somebody comes to Minsure and it turns out that, you know, they put in their information, they're eligible for public programs. There's a handoff to counties, and there's been issues there that are better but not still not fixed, right? So I think we all understand that. But this is what we're talking about here is people who are not eligible for public programs. So as I understand it, maybe the commissioner can correct me if I'm wrong, but there's no county piece to this at all, because these are people that are not even eligible now for help with their premiums. We're talking, well, let me correct that. The 20% is for everybody who's buying on the private market, but the state-based premium tax credit is only for people who right now, as Representative Schultz said, get no help. So these are not people who are eligible for public programs.
Mr. Chair.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, but the Minsure program, which is what we're talking about, the programming, and you're talking about expanding and updating the program so we can accommodate this additional change, is what the counties use, because it's all been lumped together. And they call it METS. I call it a mess. There's last I talked to them, they were able to accommodate three or four changes every few months when there were hundreds of changes needed. And at one point, they couldn't even take someone out of the system that had died. They couldn't add people that were born. They couldn't make any changes. They had to go through 18 different screens to change an address for one person, and then they had to change addresses for every person in the household, which took another 18 screens. It's it may be the worst system that the state of Minnesota has ever created, but then Minlar's happened. But this actually is worse. I'm wondering, are we doing anything besides fixing little tiny itty-bitty problems compared to the massive problem that the counties have to navigate that? That's the same program.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative O'Neill. Well, it's not the same program. And, you know, it's Minsure has several different functions. And as I said, the handoff to the counties on public programs is what you're talking about. Mm-hmm. This is not having to do with any handoff to the counties. The counties have no role in this, as far as I am aware, at all. So, yeah, in the Health and Human Services bill, you're going to find things that pertain to counties, and, you know, there's a lot we do in the Health and Human Services space that involves counties. What we're talking about here does not involve counties, even though it, yes, it's being carried in the same bill as some of those things. But and as I'm as I understand it too, what is planned in terms of the technology for this is to use a program that's been used in other states, a vendor with a, you know, off the, I don't know if it's completely correct to call it off the shelf, but it's a very well proven piece of technology. And just because Minsure is the umbrella organization does not mean it's the same technology that's being used. This is a new program, and my understanding is it has nothing at all to do with METS.
Mr. Chair.
Representative O'Neill.
Well, now I'm just really confused, because so now you're creating a whole new program that's outside of the initial program that took, I don't even know how many years to try to build, and it wasn't built well. And yet, yes, it was called METS until, I mean, that's what the counties call it on their side, because they had used their legacy program, which now they wish they could go back to. But I mean, that was my gosh, it was green screens that we had used back in the 80s. And when they had millennials come in, they're like, what is this? We don't even know what this is. Now they wish they had the green screens back. But in any case, so now you're talking about it's a whole different program, not, I guess I'm really confused. So now you're doing an entirely different program, which obviously will have to be modified. And how long will that take? And when will this actually launch?
Representative Liebling.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative O'Neill, you're doing a great job of trying to confuse everybody here. This is not about the public programs. Actually, Minsure does a very good job right now of helping people with the premium tax credits. It's already been doing this for quite a long time, where people who apply on the private apply through Minsure, and they're not eligible for public programs, and they're going to get a premium tax credit, and they get that through Minsure, as far as I'm aware, pretty well, because I don't hear any complaints about that piece of it. And that's the piece that is, you know, is being added to. and so that is not METS. And so you can use this opportunity to go through all that stuff about, you know, ancient history. Some of it, you know, it's a totally different topic that I would argue is not really in this committee today. It's a different topic. What's being proposed here is already, part of it is already kind of working through MNSHR very well, and it has nothing to do with METS.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I'll just wrap it up. I mean, I'm not quite sure exactly what we're creating here for doing, like, another database. And, you know, we've had insane issues with our databases from MNLARS to MNSHR, which had been called METS, and I'm not sure exactly what we're talking about now. I have had extensive conversations with my county. I've sat there at the computer and looked at the programming, and I've, you know, maybe it's a totally different program. So with this new program that's apparently not METS and not MNSHR, I'm not sure what it is, when is the effective date? When does this actually start? I thought I heard something about 2021, but when does this 20% discount actually become effective, and when can people access it?
Commissioner Bowerly.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Representative O'Neill, and I'll try to do my best to answer Representative Fabian's questions about the technology build as I try to explain how this is going to roll out. As we put together the governor's proposal for stabilizing the individual market, and which is carried again, thank you to Chair Liebling, is the first piece of it is a 20% subsidy reduction. So when people go to enroll in their plan this fall, they will see the 20% reduction available then. The for next year, for the health insurance that they are purchasing for next calendar year. And then we will roll out the tax credit portion of the plan. And so that will be built into for the following plan year, which is the same as a tax year. And so that will be, so the following fall, so in the fall of 2020, the tax credit would become available. And then in the following year, some of the other elements of the OneCare proposal are going into place. And I will assure you that as the administration was developing these plans, one of the reasons we are rolling this out in phases is to ensure that we can get the technology right so that we can deliver for our customers. So Representative Fabian, you had asked about the technology build. It's my understanding that there's a little over $1 million in fiscal year 20 to build, to make the changes to the MNSHR, the exchange system, so that it will be able to accommodate the tax credit and the subsidy, and then in 21, another $1 million. So that's about a little over $2 million on technology of that, of the line you see for the MNSHR expenditure in the 2021 biennium of 5.7. And then about $3 million is dedicated to those FTEs who are going to complete all of those tasks. I can go through those again if you like, and also help people navigate the system and understand what they are purchasing. And then there's an additional $500,000 for outreach grants. All of these costs that you see, as you will also see, they have zeros as you move forward for the MNSHR, because they will be covered by MNSHR premium withholdings beginning in 2022. So that is the breakdown of some of those, more of those costs. We can we're happy to, you know, give you any additional breakdown you would like. I do want all the committee and Mr. Chair to know that as we built this proposal across the administration, there are a number of different agencies involved. We worked hard to make sure that we could have a plan that would deliver the technology. We understand the challenges. There are customers, too. And we this plan phases in these parts of the program so that we can make sure we get the technology right for our customers.
Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I think it's important to kind of go back to what is this about. And this is about the people who don't have the benefit of employer-subsidized health insurance. They make too much money to qualify for state-paid programs, and they make too much to qualify for the federal advanced premium tax credit, which this is modeled after. The state advanced premium tax credit is just an add-on for people who earn over 400% of poverty. And these are the people we've been hearing from that have, you know, high deductible plans if they can afford even the premium for that, and it doesn't kick in until they put in the first $15,000, $20,000, $25,000, $30,000 before their insurance company steps up. And so some of them have been dropping it because they just feel like, I'll never be able to pay that bill to even get any benefit out of it. And this is to make health insurance affordable for people who work for employers who aren't able to offer a subsidy or a benefit, but who still want to cover themselves and their family. And it's a lot of small businesses, it's a lot of independent businesses, and their employees. And that's what we're talking about. And I don't see the complication with adding on a state advanced premium tax credit, because we've been doing the federal advanced premium tax credit without problem, without any issue. And we did do the 20% rebate under the first year after the exchange was set up, and it worked fine. It's bringing it back so that it's direct accountability. And I think for customers, they're going to love being able to see, put in their income numbers and see what they're going to get as a reduction in premiums when they're trying to decide what can they as a household afford over the next year. And I don't think any of this is exotic. I think it's all been proven within the state of Minnesota. And I think it's the right thing to do to step up for families and households right now that aren't finding anything that works for them in the private market. And this will take some of that edge off and make it a predictable item in their budget.
Chair Davis.
Well, thank you very much. Just regarding the last comments, the first 25% rebate was not run through MNsure. It was run through the insurance companies, and it was an extremely successful, well-run, efficient program.
Mr. Bowerly, thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right, continuing on the for testimony, we have Gary Wordish and then Emily Myatt. We will try to limit testifiers to about 2 minutes if possible. So, right. Welcome.
Well, thank you. Good afternoon, Chairman and the committee members. I'm Gary Wordish. I'm president of Minnesota Farmers Union, or grassroots organization representing farmers and rural communities around the state. This bill, we've held what we call Rural Voices discussions around the state the last couple of years, and we started a new series of them again now. And the number one issue we hear as we go around the state is the high cost of health care. You know, and Representative just made comment about that. You know, the people are paying as high as $45,000 a year in health care costs. And with the low profits on the farm economy right now, that's just unsustainable. So I guess I'm here today to this bill includes a number of provisions that are important to our farmers, including the One Care buy-in proposal, which we are eager to see passed into law. But today I want to speak in support of the one critical provision that we need to take action on this year, is repealing the sunset of the provider tax. You know, farmers are small business owners. As you're well aware, it is well publicized that, you know, the University Extension, the median farm income was $26,000 this last year, which is the lowest in, I believe, 23 years, and the bottom 20% actually lost $72,000. So, unfortunately, in this tough economy, you know, a lot of the farmers are qualifying for public programs. The provider tax is a key funding source for these programs and others that provide a safety net for farmers, small business owners across the state. You know, it's a time-tested, reliable source of funding. If you remember, you know, this program was started in 92, if I have my years right, under bipartisan legislatures, just like we have today, and a Republican governor, Ernie Carlson. You know, it's worked very well. When that passed, I remember I had a local neighbors of ours, young dairy farmers, I think at that time they had three small children. And after that passed, that got passed in the law, they, you know, visiting with them, they said, now we can have some health care. Now we can afford to buy health care. I had a member just in this last year out in western Minnesota made the comment that they were able to come back and start their farm, kind of gradually work into their father's operation. And their access to be able to buy into the MNCARE program allowed them to come back to the farm. Without that, they said they would not have been able to come back to the farm. You know, this is a time-tested program. It's worked well. you know, as I stated earlier, it can be done. It was started under bipartisan legislature and under a Republican governor, and you know, very similar to what we have today. So I, you know, that as we, you know, as I travel around the state and talk to members, people are just, you know, why can't we get together and figure this out instead of just arguing about it and playing politics with our health care? And you know, I'm in front of a political body today, so I maybe shouldn't have said that, but that's what I'm hearing. You know, people are frustrated. You know, I heard some argument back and forth during this committee, which is fine, but let's sit down and get it together. So now this will help keep farmers on the farm, so it's another option for them. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. We have Emily Myatt and Mary Creakey is on deck.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Emily Myatt, and I'm the Government Relations Director for the American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network, the nonprofit, nonpartisan advocacy affiliate of the American Cancer Society. I'm here today in support of the provision to repeal the sunset of the provider tax. Over 30,000 Minnesotans will be diagnosed with cancer this year, many of whom are receiving health care coverage through Minnesota's health insurance safety net programs, which are funded in part by the provider tax. The health care provider tax is a time-tested, reliable way to fund these essential health care services and enable critical investments in the state and well-being of Minnesota's communities. Programs funded by the Healthcare Access Fund, like Minnesota Care and Medical Assistance, mean more Minnesotans have access to preventative care, resulting in increased early detection of cancers, better outcomes, and improved survival rates for patients and survivors. Cancer patients who are uninsured when diagnosed with cancer are 60% more likely to die than patients who have access to health insurance coverage. Preserving access to health insurance saves lives. We also support the other programs out of the Healthcare Access Fund that increase access to care and help create healthier communities. For example, the Statewide Health Improvement Partnership has led to community grants to help prevent chronic diseases like cancer. Letting the provider tax sunset would be catastrophic to the financial health of Minnesota and would jeopardize access to health care for thousands of vulnerable Minnesotans and threaten prevention programs needed to curb rising health care costs. Too many depend on the programs for the legislature to experiment with funding options or to eliminate the Healthcare Access Fund altogether. With no reliable alternatives being presented, the continuation of the provider tax in Minnesota is the right decision for our citizens and our communities. I believe in your packets is a joint letter from the American Cancer Society, Cancer Action Network, and the American Heart Association in support of the continuation of the provider tax. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Now up, Mary Creakey, Kate Lynch is on deck. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mary Creakey, and I'm with the Minnesota Hospital Association. The Hospital Association supports the repeal of the sunset on the provider tax as contained in the Omnibus Health and Human Services Bill. Over the last two decades, our members have really had somewhat of a conversion on the provider tax issue, and we've come to appreciate the many good things that have been accomplished because of the Minnesota Care Provider Tax, primarily and most importantly, that is coverage for low-income Minnesotans, either on our Minnesota Care program or in our medical assistance program. The question that I get asked the most often is, how will this impact our rural hospitals? And I'd like to just share with you three quick points. The provider tax is not applied to any Medicare services. So for most of our rural hospitals, the Medicare population may represent as much as 50 to 60% of their patients, and there is no provider tax on any Medicare service. Number two, the federal government CMS has acknowledged the provider tax as an allowable cost on the critical access hospitals cost reports. We have 77 critical access hospitals in Minnesota, and the provider tax has been acknowledged as being an allowable cost built into their base so that they can get that money back from Medicare. And the third point that I'd like to leave with the committee is that for most rural hospitals, they have pretty small volumes of patients, and any uptick in the uninsured rate really does impact our rural hospitals because they have no economies of scale. So I just would like to leave the committee with a little bit of numbers, because this is the tax committee, and the provider tax is in place for the first 6 months of the biennium under current law, but it would go away for the last 18 months of the biennium. That represents $970 million. If any portion of that is used in our medical assistance program, that money leverages a federal matching dollar. So I just can't imagine what our health and human services budget would look like without that money. It is highly unlikely that our commitment to the sick, the elderly, or the disabled would be able to be maintained without the provider tax. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Leslegard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Rural Minnesota, where I'm from, if I could ask you a question, does this help or hurt the provider tax?
Ms. Krenke?
Mr. Chairman and Representative, the provider tax absolutely helps rural Minnesota. It enables us to keep coverage in our Medicaid and Minnesota Care program. And as I mentioned, any amount of uptick in our uninsured rate really hurts a small hospital because there's no economies of scale. We just really have to maintain the coverage for folks.
Well, thank you.
Thank you very much. Other questions? Thank you very much. Kate Lynch and then Dave Renner.
Good afternoon, Chair Mark Renner and members of the committee. My name is Kate Lynch. I live in Roseville. For the past 30 years, I've worked in a Twin Cities clinic, all of that time as an LPN in the pediatric department. I'm a member of SEIU Healthcare Minnesota and have been elected to our executive board. Our union represents 35,000 healthcare workers in hospitals, clinics, nursing homes, and self-directed home care. We support House File 2414 because much of the care that we provide depends on the $700 million a year generated by the provider tax. If I had one word to describe our healthcare system now, that word would be fragile. The provider tax is an essential pillar, and it would be incredibly dangerous to take it away. SEIU members all over the state know that our healthcare system depends on the provider tax. Hospital workers in small rural hospitals know that a large share of their patients' base rely on medical assistance in Minnesota care. Excuse me. Nursing home and home care workers know that if you get rid of the provider tax, there would not be enough general fund dollars to solve the workforce shortages that they face. Some of you may think that this is an opportunity to eliminate wasteful spending on the system, but every day, healthcare workers like me that see nothing is more wasteful than denying care because patients don't have insurance. This is always especially heartbreaking when you work with children. I remember a family with an asthmatic child who was being treated properly at our clinic. The family lost their insurance, and instead of low-cost regular treatments that were keeping him stable, they were forced into getting far more expensive and less accurate treatments in the emergency room. I can't imagine the stress of waiting for your child's breathing to get so bad that the emergency room will have no choice but to treat them. In this case, everyone lost. The family racked up a small fortune of medical debts they could never pay. The healthcare system had to devote extra resources to solve a crisis that could have been prevented, and all of us had to pay a little extra to cover the costs. Worst of all, small children have to suffer through terrifying attacks that left them unable to breathe. Nothing is more wasteful than letting a treatable illness destroy a patient. There is no better investment than preventing people from getting sick and treating a disease before it gets worse and damages a person forever. We have the tools and resources to give Minnesotans the care they need to live decent lives. The provider tax is one of those tools. As a tax, it has performed reliably for three decades through every kind of economy. Please don't let it sunset, and please keep, let healthcare workers keep giving the care that people need. Thank you.
Dave Renner is now up, and then Kenza Hajmusa is on deck. Welcome.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Dave Renner, here today representing the 10,000 physician and medical student members of the Minnesota Medical Association. And just to make clear, the MMA does oppose the repeal of the sunset of the provider tax. This sunset was agreed to in a bipartisan manner with Republican legislature and Governor Mark Dayton back in 2011, and it is scheduled to end at the end of this year. We support the sunset, and we encourage you to honor the commitment from 2011. The MMA, however, does support the goals of Representative Liebling and many of those who are hearing to ensure that we have a critical health funding for our critical health care access and safety net programs. To let the provider tax sunset without identifying ongoing funds would be irresponsible. We encourage you to think creatively on identifying ongoing funding, and we ask as you move forward, you consider an updated, modernized finance mechanism other than the provider tax. The MMA believes that there is a way forward to preserve coverage and to ease the cost and burden of tax compliance for healthcare providers and provide stable ongoing sources. The MMA has been working over the last year with consultants and has developed an alternative, which is referred to as the claims expenditure assessment, and this is included in Representative Morrison's House File 2789. The claims expenditure assessment moves the collecting and the paying of the tax off of providers upstream to health plans and third-party administrators. The advantages of this assessment is that it is still based broad, as broad-based as the provider tax, but it's only assessed on paid claims. So patients who are paying out-of-pocket are not taxed. Patients who are paying for services that are not covered by insurance are not taxed. It also removes the administrative burden of collection and payment and audits from small providers like medical clinics, dentists, chiropractors, and psychologists. Well, while there are many states that use some form of provider taxes, Minnesota is the only state to levy such a tax on outpatient providers. In other where this has been used in other states, courts have found that this is not preempted by ERISA, so this can be assessed to both commercial insurance and self-insured market. Because it is only paid on paid claims, it is less of a sick tax. And by moving the collection and the payment of the tax from providers to payers, the number of entities paying the tax is reduced from approximately 8,000 currently who pay the provider tax to potentially less than 100 payers and third-party administrators. Mr. Chair, it is critical that we continue to provide ongoing funding dedicated to our health care access programs. We believe the claims expenditure assessment is an alternative to the provider tax that should be seriously considered as you work to pass the final Health and Human Services budget. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Kenza Haja Musa, and then we have Dominic McQuarrie is on deck. Welcome.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Kenza Haja Musa. I'm here today on behalf of Take Action Minnesota. We're a grassroots organization. We strongly support this bill and are here to speak to two tax provisions in it. First, we believe our government is responsible for making health care work for everyone. We continue to support the continuation of the health care provider tax, along with many others testifying today, and the nearly 150 organizations who signed on to a letter of support to support the tax. Second, we strongly support the state-based tax credits proposed in this bill that address a problem with the Affordable Care Act. Federal advanced premium tax credits give protection against high premiums to Minnesotans with incomes between 200 and 400% of the federal poverty level. But then the credits drop off. For Minnesotans with incomes just above that line, the state-based tax credits give them a premium affordability standard for the first time. Healthcare affordability is about much more than just premiums, which is why we support many other non-tax provisions in this bill, especially the One Care Platinum buy-in, to make sure that health insurance really covers people's needs. But to the extent that Minnesotans are stuck in the individual private health insurance market, those above 400% of the federal poverty level also need the security of knowing that if the benchmark premium rises above 10% of their income, they'll qualify for assistance. State-based tax credits are a responsible solution as we work toward larger health care reforms. I also just want to say my family owned a small business for 30 years, and by the end, we're paying $30,000 a year for health care that they couldn't even afford to use, so it would help a lot of people. Thank you.
Thank you. Dominic McQuarrie and then Melissa Heising.
Hello. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Dominic McQuarrie. I'm Public Policy Manager at the Amherst H. Wilder Foundation and serve as co-convener of the This Is Medicaid Coalition, a broad coalition of more than 50 organizations that works to protect the health care of Minnesotans who receive it through Medicaid. So along with the 150 other Minnesota-based organizations that are on a letter, we support the full restoration of the health care provider tax that's within House File 2414. It's the piece of this large and complex bill that unites nearly every health and human service watcher this session. Minnesota has long led the nation in providing affordable health care to our families, neighbors, and communities. It's the reason that we're often at the top of rankings like the healthiest state and highest in labor force participation. We invest in our people and we see returns. Still, our health care system is imperfect. We need to build our mental health system, invest in services to keep people with disabilities in community, ensure our seniors have safe care in their final chapters of their lives, and Minnesota's communities, rural, metro, and everything in between can only thrive when people get the health care that they need. It's a key linchpin in our healthcare system, and almost every state's healthcare system has a provider tax. And as opposed to certain other proposals this session, this is the only one that's time-tested, court-tested, and a reliable revenue source to raise the amount of revenue that we need to cover our healthcare needs. We often forget in these debates about healthcare and taxes that, like it or not, our fates are intertwined with those of our neighbors and fellow Minnesotans. This debate is about each of us and the people that we love. Across the street in the Senate, there's talk about solving this issue with the sunset by cutting dental and vision coverage for potentially hundreds of thousands of MA and Minnesota Care enrollees. While these glasses are very stylish, they're not just for show. I do actually have very bad eyes, and there's no way I would have been able to drive in here today or do my job every day if I didn't have access to the vision coverage that I need. And I know that's true of a lot of people who are doing their current jobs, let alone those who are losing work and need to retrain for new skills looking at screens all day. And that's just the proposal that we have today. As the healthcare access fund is drained, we don't know what will be on the chopping block next. What we do know is we want Minnesotans to have access to the care that they need when they need it. Rolling back the clock on the provider tax and letting it expire will take us back to a time when more Minnesotans were subject to the real tax on the sick, the tax of being uninsured, sick, and out of options. So on this miserable, miserable day, we support the effort to keep the sun shining bright on Minnesota's healthcare. Thank you.
Thank you. Melissa Heising. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Melissa Heising. I'm Legislative Director for Minnesota AFL-CIO, a labor federation made up of more than 1,000 affiliate unions representing more than 300,000 working people across the state. Repealing the sunset of the provider tax is one of our top five legislative priorities this year. The provider tax funds essential health care services for over a million Minnesotans and enables critical investments in the health and well-being of Minnesota's communities. Allowing the health care provider tax to expire would create an annual revenue shortfall of $680 million. This loss of funding will jeopardize health care access for thousands of low-income Minnesotans, threaten the stability of health care, and negatively impact the state budget. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Is there anyone else in the audience who would like to testify on House File 2414? See none. Representative Schumacher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And there's a lot of different points that we could talk about with this bill, but I just wanted to focus a little bit more on the health care access, or the provider tax that we have in front of us today. The long and short is that this is a regressive tax. Our own tax incidence studies tell us that. You can look at a benefit incidence study and show that the people who are at the lowest, the bottom rungs, are getting a benefit from it and therefore would make it less regressive. But if you aren't one who qualifies for that, if you're in the middle, making a little bit more than what it takes to get a benefit, but less than, well, anyone who's making more than you, it is still a regressive tax. And so for that reason alone, I would vote no with this, because it's really affecting the people who are stuck in the middle. Secondly, we have seen in the last 20 years that the growth in the healthcare access fund from the provider tax is three times that of what we've received in the general fund in that same period of time. And so, really, it's no wonder that over the lifespan of the healthcare access fund, that over that almost half the time that the healthcare access fund has been available, that we've been using the funds for things other than Minnesota Care, including expanding Medicaid. And finally, once again, we are making ourselves an island with our approach on this in our tax policy. No other state has a provider tax that's created in such a way to do such a thing. Other states have what they refer to as a provider tax, but none do it the way we do. And so, members, I would just ask that we vote no on this bill today, because this regressive provider tax contributes to and benefits from the high cost of health care. Thank you.
Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And part of the reason that Minnesota Care was created 26 years ago was because we realized that when you have a lot of uninsured people, it increases the cost of everyone with insurance. because the uninsured still get sick. And they, under federal law and good ethics in our society, no one is turned away when they're sick. Every hospital will accept you, whether you have insurance or not. That is their moral and legal obligation. And what happens when you have a lot of uninsured people, or people who can only pay 5 or 10% over a 10-year premium payment plan back to the hospital, is that all that care cost shifts into the pricing of the hospital to the insurance companies for all the rest of us. And it's been well-researched and documented that the costs of the uninsured end up on the insurance rates of everyone else. And by passing Minnesota Care, financed by the premium tax and the provider tax credit, Minnesota reduced its uninsurance rate. We compete oftentimes. We're usually number two in terms of the amount of uninsured in the state. But it has been going up, which is a big concern, but it's because of those people over 400% of poverty getting no help and the insurance premiums going through the roof with huge high deductibles that people just cannot afford. And so this actually prevents that cost shifting and benefits every single person in the insurance market and every employer who contributes to insurance costs. That's why we did it, and it showed. We have some of the lowest premium costs of the nation. They're still startling high for anyone in Minnesota. But when you compare our rates with the rest of the nation, we're looking pretty darn good. Unfortunately, we have to bring costs under control, and we've been working on that as well. And that's with the statewide health improvement partnership and some of the other components of the Healthcare Access Fund we're set up to do, which is to reduce the cost of health care. Yes, it has grown faster than the rate of growth in other tax revenue sources, and that is by design. It is based on health care costs so that it grows at the rate of medical inflation. And that has meant that even so, though this bill has existed for over 25 years and has provided that if there was a shortfall in funding, that we would reduce benefits, that we would freeze enrollment, and we would drop people from enrollment, we've never had to do that because it was based on a revenue source that grows with the medical cost rate of inflation, which unfortunately is much higher than the consumer price index and what the wage increases that we see in our income tax receipts. And it has allowed, and the MA expansion actually took some people who were on Minnesota Care and put them onto full 90% federal reimbursement, which is a good thing for us, and that has allowed us to do some other things. Yes, Minnesota is unique and different, and it's because we have stepped up for our people consistently, and as a result, we have some of the lowest rates of uninsured in the nation, and I'm proud of this bill stepping up to saying that those who earn over 400% of poverty, which isn't that much money, 100% of poverty is about $10,000 a year. So it's not that much money. But this says we're going to step up to those moderate income people, and we're going to make sure that they can cover themselves, whether they happen to, and that they can fulfill their dream, whether that's working in the farm economy, working for a small employer, or starting their own small business. And those groups are disproportionately represented in the group that's. And if you want to talk about regressivity, there is nothing more regressive that can happen in someone's life than to delay getting a cancer or other life-threatening diagnosis that could have been caught earlier if you felt like you could go in and get regular care and regular diagnostic tests. And your chances are much less. And even if you beat the odds because of modern medicine, your costs will be dramatically higher because of that. And that is the most regressive thing we can do, is not provide for all of our people the chance to catch things early and, even better yet, prevent those things from happening in the first place. And that's another thing that the Healthcare Access Fund funds.
Chair Davis.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. When I look at this bill, I kind of think of on the farm, we used to say if you're losing $10 per hog, you should probably raise more hogs, because that's kind of what's going on here. We heard earlier that MnSure was just a website, just a little website, that we've spent taxpayers' dollars over $600 million on that have gone down the black hole. And as far as getting people better access with this bill, it doesn't change the deductibles. You still have a $6,500 deductible. You're still going to wait. And that cancer is going to grow because of the situation we've been put in here. Members, this bill continues the sick tax. And when I think of the sick tax, I think of back on the farm, we used to have like a Minneapolis Millen two-row corn picker, and it would get clogged up pretty easy. And so the farmer would go in, pull the corn stalks out of the corn picker, and it would recoil, even though everything was off, and his arm would go in there, and it took his arm off. We had a lot of that. So now, in the, my beloved Minnesota, you go to the emergency room at the mothership in Rochester, and you get your arm taken care of. Well, get taken care of. $300,000. And, oh, by the way, in Minnesota, we're going to tax you another X percent. Now, that's just not very nice. You're sick. A heart attack, it's a regressive tax on cancer treatment, heart attacks, births, accidents. And after you pay the tax on your health care, the government is going to send off some of that money directly to insurance companies. So we're sending money, writing checks to insurance companies. That's why they need more people to insure. One of the reasons, yes, some of it's for call centers. I get that. So, you know, I'm good at naming tax bills, probably the best in the history of the country. I usually don't name HHS bills, but I think we just have to name this one. I can't think of a song necessarily, but this is Omnibus Prime on steroids is what this bill is. And so I totally agree with Chair Schumacher. This bill deserves a no vote. Thank you, members.
Representative Liebling, closing comments.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And first of all, I'd like to thank all of the testifiers who came up. And I want to especially thank Representative Loeffler, too. She's actually the author of the provider tax provision that is in the bill. And she gave a lot of she gave an excellent closing statement that was really kind of said a lot of what I would have wanted to say. I do just want to respond to a couple things I heard here today. And first of all, the analogy that this is like you paid off your mortgage and then you're being asked to pay more. No, 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 no. Obviously, that's a failed analogy. When you pay off your mortgage, you had a set amount of money that you were supposed to pay, and you're paying it off in installments. And when you've paid it off, you've paid it off. This is more like if I planned to quit my job, and then I decided not to quit my job, would I be able to say that I'm getting a raise? No. It's just the same money that continues to come in. That is, you know, this is not a tax increase. That's just a false and misleading statement. A lot has been said here about, you know, the complaints. You know, I just would point out that reinsurance was supposed to be a temporary solution, market stabilization, a bridge to something, but it turned out to be a bridge to nowhere because there's no solution offered. You know, obviously it's very difficult. Healthcare is obviously very complicated, but at the end of the day, you got to do something to try to help these people. And this bill, while it certainly isn't perfect, it is trying to do something. And I think you know that by the people who came up here and gave their very heartfelt testimony about why it's so important to keep the provisions in this bill, and especially to keep the provider tax in place. You know, it's so fascinating to me that this, if you want to call this bill Omnibus Prime, tell me where the road projects are. Tell me where the environmental projects are in this bill. There aren't any. This bill is about health care. This bill does so many things to improve health care for Minnesotans, to give Minnesotans the opportunity to be healthier. It's hard to even describe this bill because it does so many important, wonderful things for Minnesotans. And it's really going to be very difficult to do any of those things going forward if we don't maintain our very important health care access fund with the revenue that's come into it. Republicans have used this fund. We talked about how we're using it now for Medicaid. Some of Medicaid's spending is being financed out of that. Guess what else? Reinsurance. They took $400 million right out of the Health Care Access Fund for that. In the Senate bill right now, they're taking some $580 million, I think, to balance their bill right out of the Health Care Access Fund. So for people to then say, oh, but we don't need the fund, I think it's just smoke and mirrors. This is a very important cornerstone of what we do in Minnesota around healthcare. And as Representative Loeffler said so beautifully, what makes us a leader. I would just refer people back to the testimony also of Mary Krinke from the Hospital Association, who talked about rural hospitals. If you have a rural hospital and you care about your community's access to that hospital, you ought to be voting for this bill. Because if you don't, you are pulling the rug right out from under your hospital, as Ms. Krinke testified. And I've known Ms. Krinke for many years. I've worked with the Hospital Association. I've been on different sides of issues with them over the years. When they speak about something this way, they mean it. They are not a partisan organization. They're all about their members and the stability and ability of their members to go forward and provide care to Minnesotans. And they've been extremely clear this session that they support removing the sunset and keeping the provider tax. And as many people have said, this is the only proven, court-tested, stable ability that we have to bring in this money that so many Minnesotans, I would argue every Minnesotan, depends on this fund. So with that, Mr. Chair, I thank you very much for the time, and thank you again to all of the great testifiers, and just would ask the committee to pass this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Liebling. I renew my motion to refer House File 2414 to the General Register. I'll now call for the vote. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay.
No.
The motion does prevail. Thank you very
Mr.
much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Next up on the agenda is House File 1555, the Omnibus Transportation Finance Bill. And while Representative Hornstein's making his way, I will move to refer House File 1555 to the General Register.
Thank you very much, Mr.
Representative Hornstein. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. It's good to be back.
Yes.
Members, I'm very happy to present to you House File 1555. This is the biennium's Omnibus Transportation Finance and Policy Division bill for the year. And there are several provisions that are of particular interest to the Tax Committee, and I will briefly go through some of the major ones. There's, of course, many of them, and but I think there's several that I think are of most interest to this committee. Before I get into those specific provisions, I do want to briefly share, Mr. Chair and committee members, the vision and philosophy behind this bill. And it's really quite simple. Minnesota's infrastructure is lagging. It is literally crumbling. Many of our roads are 50 years old. They are in desperate need of repair and maintenance. In fact, the American Society of Civil Engineers, a nonpartisan and well-respected organization that gives report cards to all the states on their infrastructure, rated Minnesota's road infrastructure as a D plus, below average. This is not conducive to our citizens' safety, mobility, and economic development challenges and opportunities that we have. Creating a strong transportation infrastructure is a prerequisite to our shared prosperity. And so our bill aligns the stated needs that I believe almost every stakeholder and both parties agreed to are the needs of the state financially in our road and bridge infrastructure. It aligns those needs with the revenue needed to address the urgent repair and maintenance of that infrastructure. In addition to roads and bridges, we also align the stated needs of our transit infrastructure with additional revenue. And I am talking both in the road and bridge sector and transit sector of needs both in the metro area and in greater Minnesota. And so this bill aligns the revenue with the need. And we raise revenue in ways that are already set aside in our budget planning for transportation needs. What I'm talking about is the constitutional dedication of the gas tax for road and bridge purposes only. And I think this bears repetition. Article 14 of the Minnesota Constitution dedicates the gas tax for roads and bridges, not for light rail transit, not for hospitals, not for schools, not for the bill that you just addressed, health care. Road and bridge infrastructure only. And so we address this problem and this challenge by raising this dedicated line of revenue by the gas tax, a fee on motor fuels, if you will, 5 cents per year over the next 4 years. And with that new revenue, we are able to not only address the maintenance needs, which are very, very significant, just maintaining the infrastructure we have now, Mr. Chair. We are able to address that problem, as well as fund many needed expansion projects and safety projects all across the state of Minnesota. Our transit challenges are very significant. We have 720,000 new residents expected in the metro area over the next 20 years. In order to address the mobility needs and challenges of that growing population, we have to make investments in our transit system, new investments, and ensure that our existing transit infrastructure is is improved and the frequency of service is increased. So we have a half-cent metro sales tax to address this. Oh, and by the way, members, I neglected to say, and it is also very important, on the road bridge side, we do have an increase in the license tab fees, and those fees consist of fees on new and, of course, existing vehicles. And in terms of the existing vehicles, many of those, and the commissioner has pointed this out, are older vehicles, 11 years and older. On those, the license tab fees are reduced. And so if you are paying for an expensive new car, yes, you will pay more under our legislation. And then finally, members, there is, I think, a fourth pretty important feature of this bill. We add revenue for deputy registrars via additional fees so that they can take care of their ongoing challenges with our new license and registration system. And then we also have additional fees so that the Department of Vehicle, the DVS Vehicle Services, will be able to be properly staffed so that our constituents can get licensed tests done in a more timely way. We have many people traveling all over the state so that their teenagers can get the driver tests administered in a timely way. We have many people that are on hold for a long time with their challenges related to delays in getting their license tabs, et cetera, processed properly. So we address that in this bill as well. Of course, there's many other provisions that are important, not necessarily directly tax-related. We do have $10 million for the deputy registrars to cover their costs that they incurred because of the challenges and delays and, quite frankly, technological failures that were associated with the rollout of the MNLAR system a couple of years ago. That money is contained in this legislation. So with that, members, I would be happy to answer questions. This bill is absolutely critical for our future. with regard to the motor vehicle sales tax, one last one, sorry. We do raise that from 6.5% to 6.875%. It's a slight increase. We are now aligning the motor vehicle sales tax with the broader sales tax rate. That will increase funding for Greater Minnesota Transit. It will also provide the first dedicated stream of money for cities below 5,000. That is very, very important. Many members are interested in that. Here and there, we have funded that those cities, but for the first time, we have a dedicated stream. That is critically important for Greater Minnesota and actually even some suburban communities. So I wanted to make sure folks were aware of that. And so then in conclusion, this is absolutely critical to move the state forward in terms of growing our economy, accommodating, I think, a very positive trend in our demographics. Many more people want to live here, work here, raise a family. We can't do that successfully without a strong road, bridge, transit infrastructure. We also have some money set aside for active transportation statewide and for bike and pedestrian choices in the metro area. So with that, members, I would be happy to take questions.
Very good. We do have some testifiers, and I think Commissioner Bowerly would go first.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Cynthia Bowerly. I'm the Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Revenue. I want to thank you, Mr. Chairman, for hearing this bill and Chair Hornstein for bringing this bill forward. Members of the committee, this bill aligns with Governor Walz's a little lapse in. I'm in a time machine. Governor Walz and Lieutenant Governor laid out their budget. They prioritized investing in our transportation system across the state of Minnesota to address our crumbling roads and bridges and expand transit opportunities. And we thank Chair Hornstein for also choosing to invest in communities across the state with this comprehensive and dedicated funding for these needs across the state. Importantly, in this bill, with the gas tax and the additional sources of revenue that go into the highway fund, 40% of the additional funding goes to local roads and road systems. That's a 35% increase in transportation funding for those Minnesota counties and cities across the state of Minnesota. And we know at the Department of Revenue that there is a growing need and recognition of this need because we see more and more counties taking advantage of the half-cent transportation sales tax option that is available to them in Minnesota law. So we know that is a growing need. And with this funding that will come through this dedicated revenue source through the formula system, it will relieve the pressure on local property taxes because they will not have to put that onto those local levies. So we appreciate the chair's comprehensive approach, including the proposal to increase the motor vehicle sales tax to 6.85% to allow for needed investments across the board. There are a number of other provisions that align with the governor's proposal, and while there are some small differences, what we appreciate is that this is a comprehensive approach to dedicated funding for the transportation needs across the state of Minnesota. And for the local metro area includes the proposal for the dedicated sales tax to be used for transit, metro mobility for individuals who need help getting around the area. And included in here is an increase as well to Greater Minnesota Transit. 8.5% of this distribution goes to Greater Minnesota Transit. So we thank the chair for this bill. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Very good. Any questions for the commissioner? Commissioner, you mentioned something about property taxes. And I know in some of the research is that if you take away what cities and counties and townships receive in, like, federal and state aid, which would be own source kind of revenues, that they're paying about $1.5 billion a year in street maintenance costs of some sort, which, according to the research I have, is about 29, almost 30% of all city, county, township levies. And in fact, that $1.5 billion is probably almost twice as much as what's currently coming in on the gas tax. So probably your biggest, and disagree with me if I'm wrong here, but it seems like almost the largest portion of kind of revenues that are going towards local roads and that are coming from the property taxpayers right now. And I was especially really good to hear the dedicated funding for cities under 5,000, which I think would go a long ways to alleviating that. But am I on track with this? And is that what you're looking at when you talk about property taxes, Commissioner?
Thank you, Chair Marquardt. Local units of government have a limited ability to raise revenue as pursuant to the statutes of Minnesota. And so the local levy, their property tax levy, so the property taxes that they ask their residents to pay on their homes, on businesses, same thing for school districts. This is the only place that they can raise revenue outside of this additional authority that was granted them a few years ago, this sales tax provision, or any other local sales tax that are adopted that are approved by the legislature. But local governments rely on property taxes, which really means homeowners, people who own property in those jurisdictions, are paying that bill.
Thank you. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And as long as we're starting getting into the tax piece of that and so forth, I think we need to also include the changes in sales tax that's going on in the metro area versus greater Minnesota, and how then the lease sales tax and others that have changed in this bill impacts them too. So now we have in other areas that are beyond actually this bill, now the 5% sales tax that counties in the metropolitan area can half a cent. Sales tax really increases the dollars available for various transportation issues. And then we look at the change in the Minnesota vehicle lease sales tax, in which the metro counties are going to get another $30 million. And then we go to the MVEST, which is the vehicle sales tax, and the change of the percentages, in which transit's going to get almost an additional $300 million for transit. For that, it seems like that's quite a change in the metro area versus greater Minnesota. And I'm not trying to make this into metro versus greater Minnesota. I'm just talking about the dollars that are growing there that really aren't about the road and bridge infrastructure that we keep talking about is the greatest need. And so that question, I'm sure we'll have further discussion about it. But isn't that a major change in direction in which we've been going for transportation needs?
Chair Marquardt and Representative Petersburg, first I want to make sure that we're talking about the same things. Number one is with the bill that I believe is had been heard in this committee, the metro counties have the authority under the law to enact that a half cent, but I'd have to do a little more research to know whether they have. So I think if your question is about, is there a greater need in the metro area that needs to be funded through some of these mechanisms, I think that is absolutely true, and I would probably defer to the chair on the details of that need. But when you say, or is this a different direction, all of the proposals that are in this bill are existing provisions in Minnesota law. So there's, to my knowledge, there's not a new provision in here that is changing the direction of how we fund the roads and bridge need in Minnesota.
Chair Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Petersburg, for the question. You know, my transportation mentor in this body was former Representative Bernie Leader. He represented a district in Crookston. And what Representative Leader taught me is that a successful transportation bill has to align the needs and the revenue for greater Minnesota and the metro area and include road, bridges, and public transit. And so we do that successfully in this bill. I don't view this, Representative Petersburg, as a change of direction. I view this as aligning with what Representative Leader did during his years here and during his very successful effort to provide new revenue for transportation in 2008. Now, when you talk about the MVEST changes and lease vehicle sales tax changes, Yes, there are some changes, but they all are resulting in additional revenue, dedicated revenue, to address the growing needs. So, yeah, we have we are aligning new revenue sources with growing needs in the state. And there are transit needs, and there are road needs, and we still have, you know, if you compare dollar for dollar, significantly more dollars going for road and bridge infrastructure than for transit. There's an increase in both, but I think there's this mythology that, you know, that this is, you know, only addressing transit needs in the metro area. Nothing could be further from the truth. I'm glad that we are. I'm proud that we are. We have that half-cent metro sales tax increase, which will some of it will be used for roads, by the way, but that will really significantly improve our transit system in the metro. But we're also funding Greater Minnesota Transit. So again, as Representative Leader taught me, cover the whole state, but cover all modes as well.
Mm-hmm. Representative Petersburg?
Mr. Chair, and we're going to have a lot of other testifiers, and I just wanted to question Commissioner Bowerly on that particular one. We'll have later discussions about this in general. Thank you.
You bet. Thank you. Representative Westlegard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it's not going to come to any surprise that I'm from Greater Minnesota, so anything that we can take, we greatly appreciate it. And how I see this, and correct me if I'm wrong, more money goes to Greater Minnesota than the metro in the gas tax percentage for what we pay in for what we receive in Greater Minnesota. Is that a fair?
No.
No?
Mr. Chair and Representative Listlegard, that's correct.
That is correct. Do you have the numbers by chance? Tommy Rukavina would be proud of me.
Mr.
Commissioner,
Chair,
welcome.
Margaret Anderson Kelleher, Commissioner of Transportation. I think what's fair to say about the funding of transportation, Representative Listlegard, is that overall, Greater Minnesota receives 60% of our current transportation funds to 40% of our road and bridge funds in the state of Minnesota. Over our prediction, the MnDOT prediction, over the next 4 to 6 years is that will climb 70% to 30%. Minnesotans in Greater Minnesota pay a slightly higher percentage of the gas tax. I believe it's about 52%. In the metro area on the motor vehicle sales tax, the issue is actually the reverse. But the percentage of dollars going out to Greater Minnesota is higher than in Metro Minnesota. And Mr. Chair, if I could just take a moment to say, I believe that's why you have seen all of the metro area counties implement a half-cent sales tax, where they have some flexibility in being able to use those dollars for either transit or their local roads and bridges. But, Mr. Chair, I know that equity and fairness is important to you and to members of this committee. The issue is that not every county in this state has the ability or can implement that half-cent sales tax, and therefore that gets to a very important part of the WALS budget, which is One Minnesota and equity for all in this transportation package.
Thank you. Representative Westlegard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just real briefly, under 5,000. I have one community in my whole district that is over 5,000. So this ability for them to have access for the remainder is extremely important. And when I come down here and I live in the metro, my mom and dad taught me to have love, joy, peace, patience, and kindness. And I tell you, my patience is extremely tested in this area with the amount of traffic that is in the congestion that is down here. So anything that we can do to help statewide, I think we should, and I think this is a wonderful bill. So thank you.
Thank you. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you. And since we started talking about that, and maybe you have this information, Commissioner. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The last I saw, it was a couple years ago, the department put out a list of the return on tax dollars in various parts of the state. It was by both metropolitan seven county area as well as Greater Minnesota. And the last one that I saw showed that for the seven-county metro area, for every dollar spent in taxes for transportation, they received a dollar and a penny's worth of return. In greater Minnesota, in some of the districts, they actually received less than the dollar for every tax dollar that they put in. So we could talk about percentages that go out there, but those that are collected out there as well, in some cases, are greater than the dollars returned back to that district. Do you have the updated version of that? Because maybe that's changed over the last couple of years, but the last one that I saw didn't indicate that greater majority.
Representative Petersburg, are you referring to all spending or just the gas tax revenues?
I believe it was all transportation.
Oh, okay, because I know the gas tax revenues, and this is off the House research short subjects on major tax aids and so forth, says that rural Minnesota pays about 53%, you said 52% of the tax, but it says here highway aid, they get back 67.3% on the gas tax. So it's one of those few things where rural Minnesota actually gets a pretty good, you know, back for the dollar. But now I'm not speaking for overall, but on
right.
the gas tax portion. And I remember also from Representative Leader used to talk about the formula, because as a first termer, I wanted to come in and change the formula some to get those under 5,000. And he would caution me that right now, the way the formula works, it really benefits rural Minnesota. And when you start opening that up, you know, then you create some problems. And so I took that wise wisdom and pulled that bill back that I had at the time. But so I mean, that's the gas tax portion of it. And Representative Petersburg, I don't know the numbers on overall. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, because, I mean, there are sales tax for vehicles and other things that go in, cab fees, and et cetera. So I just wanted to know if that study is still available. So maybe we can see that a little bit later. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I know it's really difficult to balance things straight right, and we all have different needs and different priorities and different abilities to fund things. And I have never raised issues about the Metro, you know, contributing more than in the gas tax than it gets back. But I have to say, I think we need to, as we're going forward, think hard about increasing how much we should increase the cost of living in the metro area. This doubles our local option sales tax to a full 1% for transit. And transit is so important. It's not a choice. In my area, I have some neighborhoods where 20 to 25% of the residents do not own one car in the household. District-wide, across my district, it's more than 1 in 10. And those people have no other option other than to bike if they're physically able or walk. Today would not be a good day to be walking. And they spend $80 to $100 a month just for bus fare, unless they happen to work for a large employer that helps subsidize part of that. And so we're asking the most expensive part of the state to increase its cost of living to provide the basics for people who need to get to work, who need to get to school, who need to take the bus to get their kid to daycare, and then take the bus from there to get to work. And it's a big price, not just in dollars, but in time. And in Health and Human Services, the bill that we heard earlier, we talked about network adequacy, and there's a requirement that you be able to get to a doctor within 30 minutes. And I said, how do you measure that? Oh, it's a mile a minute. I said, there's no time in my life I think I could go a mile a minute in the metro. but I looked, and to get to a doctor's appointment in downtown Minneapolis with the absolute best bus service from my area would take an hour and a transfer to go to the largest outpatient clinic in downtown Minneapolis and an hour back. So that's 2 hours to go less than 10 miles. And so you can see why transit is so important to those of us from the metro area. And transit-dependent people are in every single part of this state, and I'm so glad, Chair Hornstein, that you have stepped up to investments in greater Minnesota, because we all have people who, because of either age or a disability or a diagnosis like epilepsy, will not be able to drive, whether they could afford a vehicle or not. And we need to make sure everyone can get to work, to school, to the doctor. And so I appreciate that you've addressed both. I just have some concerns about the level of increase in the metro area and whether or not it will will show up for that basic bus rider who's sitting outside today, not in a bus shelter because most of our stops don't have those, but waiting to go. And I know Chair Harmstein knows that because he takes transit every single day.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't know where we're going to go with the conversation with regards to this bill in the committee. I know we want to stick to the tax portion of it. But some of the things that have been mentioned, I'm curious to know, and I have a lot of cities under 5,000, what's the average payment per year to a city under 5,000?
Representative Hornstein, would you know what that would equate to right now?
Mr. Chair, I'll defer to Mr. Lee. I don't know if he's available.
Good.
Good question.
Mr. Lee?
This is a good question to contemplate.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, Andrew Lee from House Fiscal Staff. I do not have the runs on me, but I believe the average payment depends on how much the total program is funded. In the current biennium, the program is funded at $8 million a year. The proposed bill would fund it at about $10 million, so it would be an increase from the previous level funding. But in terms of the average per city, that's something that I'll have to get back to the committee, if that's all right.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I look forward to that. When you talked about your experience with former member leader and him cautioning you on the CASA formula, and the impact on rural Minnesota, I don't know if Representative Hornstein remembers or not, but about 5 years ago, we had a meeting up in one of the rooms above us with five county engineers. And in 2008, if I remember correctly, the CASA formula was changed. And according to the county engineers that we met with that day, they said that when that change was made, it became less favorable for rural counties. And what they came in asking for that day, when you were the chair in the 13-14 biennium, they laid out a case about changing the funding formula to make it again more favorable, or maybe splitting the difference or something, and that at that time wasn't something that you were willing to do. And I'm curious to know if there's any changes proposed in the CASA formula.
Chair Hornstein.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and Representative Fabian. It's a good question, and you know, it's interesting. I've had members on both sides of the aisle, new members, come up to me, and when they've figured out the Metro members, and when they've kind of figured out what you know was said on the record here earlier today, that the CASA formula does give Greater Minnesota an advantage, they get upset. And they say, are you going to change the formula? Just similar have you asked. And I said, well, once we start opening that up, again, as Representative Leader said, it causes World War III in a sense. And I think overall, at least in the transportation arena in Minnesota legislature, I think overall there is equity and there is balance in this bill. I believe all corners of the state needs are addressed. And if you look at the CASA formula, again, as an overall package, we've seen that there's advantages to Greater Minnesota, particularly when we look at the revenue from the motor fuels tax portion of it. But I think overall, there is a slight advantage, and I don't see a need to tinker with the formula, but I do see a need to add revenue to that existing formula, and that's what we're doing in this bill.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So from my constituents' point of view, that's been expressed to me pretty loud and clear, the gas tax increases is something that they're not the least bit interested in. But under your proposal, raising it 5 cents per year over the next 4 years, Mr. Chair, is that correct?
Correct.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
So, thank you, Mr. Yep. Chair, if I could continue.
You bet.
Representative Hornstein, if you increase the gas tax by 5 cents per year, and I'm looking at spreadsheets, and again, I'm not very good at some of these things, but it appears to me that we're actually going to go backwards. If we undedicate the motor vehicle sales tax that's dedicated to the general fund, and what was the other one? The rental vehicles, so forth. I mean, the total number of dollars that are being undedicated to transportation, and then now putting in the new revenue from the gas tax is actually going backwards in terms of funding in there. Am I missing something?
Representative Horns.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, no. We are adding revenue even if you make the calculations that you're making, which are important because, yes, there is revenue being taken from the statutory dedication of the auto parts sales tax going back to the general fund. You're correct in that. But that is not only replaced, that is added. We have significant additions, and that is via a portion of the gas tax. It's via the registration fees, primarily on the roadside. We also, through the MVEST increase from 6.5 to 6.875, that is another revenue stream where we will see an increase that would benefit those northern counties that you represent.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But that's in the second year, I think. In the first year where it's just 5 cents, I feel like we're going backwards, but that's a conversation we can have at another time. But I am curious, and maybe staff can help out. I'm just trying to create a hypothetical with the purchase of a different vehicle. Hypothetically, if we take what you're proposing and someone goes out and purchases a different vehicle and they spend $20,000, when we add the increase in tab fees, and let's just say you're buying a used vehicle that's 3 years old and you can still spend $20,000 pretty easily on that, how much is it going to cost additionally to purchase that vehicle with the tab fees, registrations, sales tax, and then if you calculate some sort of an average number of miles driven in, I'll say, rural Minnesota, how much more is it going to cost to operate and own that vehicle per year?
Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Ms. Chair, and thank you for the question, Representative Fabian, and it's a good one. I'll have Mr. Lee, I think, has some of that information compiled already, so
great.
He can answer that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Lee could enlighten us on some.
You bet, Mr. Lee.
Some of those, I'll say, hypotheticals, but they're really not hypotheticals when you actually go out and make that purchase.
Mr. Lee.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, in the bill on page 26 and 27, you'll see the change in the registration tax. There's a few interactions that happen specific to the registration tax. The first is the rate of the tax increases from 1.25% to 1.5%, and then the depreciation window of the registration tax, which is currently 90, 80, 70, 60, 50, and so on, skews slightly higher in the current years and then is decreased in the 11th year and on. Now, the change would happen if you were to buy a new vehicle, excluding your current vehicle. So there's a provision that you can see that's in current law that is retained in the bill on 27.21 that says that any vehicle previously registered in Minnesota, regardless of prior ownership, the total amount due under the subdivision of subdivision 1M must not exceed the smallest total amount previously paid or due on the vehicle. So the registration tax increase would not apply to vehicles that someone currently owns, but going forward, if you were to buy a new vehicle, that's when that increase would happen. I can get the committee a run of what various cost points would be. You mentioned 50, 20, 30, things like that, over the lifespan of the registration tax. As regards to the sales tax, that increase would, again, depend on the price at the point of sale. And that would be an increase of 3.75% for the sales tax. And then for the gas tax, The Department of Transportation did an estimate of assuming a 20-mile per gallon fuel efficiency at 15,000 miles traveled in 1 year, consuming 750 gallons. The current tax, a driver would pay $214 per year, and the increase would be $150 per year for the fuel tax.
Representative Baby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, it's nice to see that my 2008 vehicle is now going to be 11 years old, and I'll probably actually see a decrease. So, no, I'm kidding. The two vehicles that I drive, Mr. Chair, are pretty safe. If I could just convince my wife to do something different.
Mr. Chair, it's very strategic, Mr. Chair, in getting Representative Fabian's support.
Okay, we're going to continue on with the testifier. Thank you, Mr. Lee.
Thank you.
And so next is Gary Wordish and then Amber Backhouse. Welcome again.
Yeah, good to be here again. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members for being here. You know, Gary Wordish again, Farmers Union, or Farmers, State President of Minnesota Farmers Union. You know, in our policy that's set by our membership, it's very clear in there, our members support a strong increase in dedicated funding for roads and bridges, which this is what the gas tax does. We held one of our Rural Voices discussions earlier this meeting or this week, and there was a number of people there, and we heard loud and clear at that meeting, we want our roads and bridges, specifically saying roads, fixed. And one of the members actually said a little more colorful language on that, but I won't say that here. But you know, there's the one thing we don't talk about a lot is since the gas tax was originally put in, the cost of building and maintaining roads, you know, we're really funding our whole structure with an outdated model, and that's a lot of our problem. You know, none of the funds going into it aren't enough to keep up. You know, I heard Commissioner Kelleher say the other day that on the MnDOT stupid projects, it was a 20 years. Some of them were on the boards for 20 years. I do remember, I'm also a county or a township supervisor in my county, Renville County. And I remember in 2008, after the last gas tax increase that we did pass in the state, with our local county township officers and the county commissioners meeting, the county engineer got up in front of everybody and put up on the board. He had five projects that gas tax allowed him to fund that year. Five projects within that county, and that, you know, that's the thing we're missing here. We need to. You know, it's a long road. I talked to a county commissioner at that same meeting in the local county, and he said the cost of the county out in the where I'm from in that Renville County area is $1.5 million to rebuild a county road. That's the problem. You know, we just have a lot. We just don't have enough funding. The price of gas went up in the last month about 40 cents a gallon. You know, did people complain about that? Not one penny of that went to roads and bridges. Not a penny. And the vast majority of that money went out of state. That's the problem. You know, raising the gas tax is a dedicated fund. Raising the gas tax or dedicated funding to roads and bridges, it's not going to cause the wheels of the cars to fall or trucks to fall off. But if we don't do anything, we're going to have, you know, farmers, you know, we depend on a good road system to get our products to market. You had rural manufacturing companies, rural small businesses that need a good transportation system if they're going to make a go of it, if they're going to compete in a global economy. So without not increasing some dedicated funding to the roads will cause the wheels to fall off in a lot of ways. You know, I've stated it earlier, we've kicked this can down the road so many times that can has fallen in the pothole and we can't even find it anymore. Well, it's just frustrating. You know, it's not on a farm, you know, homeowners, you know, Metro, you can relate that too. You know, your roof starts, yeah, I know, Paul's cutting me off again. Sorry about that. Your roof starts leaking on your house. You can patch it. But at some point, you got to fix it. You know, we're spending a lot of money putting asphalt in patches. You all drive by, you know, the county people or state people were putting, with shovels, putting asphalt in the potholes. A couple weeks later, they're doing it again. So my time is off. So thank you, Paul, and we support an increase in funding for the roads and bridges. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Wazinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is just a question in general. There had been some talk around the Capitol at times, as most people know, farmers, we don't spend, we don't pay gas tax on fuel that we use in the field. Yeah. And where would the Farmers Union be on that if that would potentially move forward, where agriculture and tractor use for fuel that we use to, you know, work out in the field be adapted to use the gas tax? Would there be much support for that?
Well, no, we wouldn't support.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Zawinski, no, we would not support putting a road and fuel tax on fuel that's used in the fields, and that's exempt now, and I'm not aware of any movement to do that, and if there was, we definitely would oppose that.
Representative Hornstein, just to make this clear, is there any movement to place tax on
farms? There is not, and the chair would also oppose that. Yeah.
Very good. I'll make that clear. Any further questions? Okay. Thank you very much. Next, we have Amber Backhouse, and then Todd Hill is on deck. There, very good. So we have Todd Hill and then Melissa Heising.
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Todd Hill with Hill Capital Strategies, and I'm here on behalf of my client, the Minnesota Service Station and Convenience Store Association. The MSSA represents nearly 400 first, second, and third generation auto care, towing, and convenience store owners and operators all across the state of Minnesota. And I'm here to testify on their behalf in opposition to two provisions in this bill, and those would be the increase in the gas tax and the increase in the metro sales tax. Nearly 95% of all fuel purchases at our members' locations are made by credit cards. And when the $600 million gas tax increase is fully implemented, this will mean an additional $12 to $17 million in credit card fees for Minnesota retailers. So we're going to be taking $12 to $15 million out of the pockets of retailers and sending that money to big banks and credit card companies. The expansion of the metro sales tax will have a similar impact on our members. Credit card costs are typically the second highest expense in a convenience store or repair facility, only typically exceeded by our rents or our mortgages. This change is beyond the millions of dollars in fees that we are currently sending to banks and credit card companies to process transactions and to collect the sales tax. We feel it's also important for you to look at the impact of this legislation along with other proposals that you've considered this week, be it the removal or the replacement of the escalator on tobacco taxes, which, contrary to popular belief, was not an effort by the big tobacco companies but actually by retailers to try to make themselves competitive, and then the 0.6% payroll tax, which was also passed this week for the paid family medical leave proposal. We hope you understand that when you raise a sales tax, an excise tax, or mandate a fee on retailers, you are taking money out of the pockets of those businesses and transferring it to banks and credit card companies. And we hope as you increase the cost of businesses to operate in the state of Minnesota, you also look at ways to minimize the impacts on the collections of these taxes, be it through prohibiting credit card companies from applying excise fees to those taxes or from things like the vendor's allowance, which we've been pursuing for a number of years. With that, I'll stand for any questions.
Thank you very much. Melissa Heising and Jessica Lake is on deck.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. Melissa Heising, Minnesota AFL-CIO. We support comprehensive transportation funding and new revenue as provided for in House File 1555, particularly the gas tax increase indexed to inflation and the local option sales tax funding for transit. The time is now to invest in Minnesota's transportation system. Our quality of life and Minnesota's economic vitality depends on having safe roads and bridges, easy access to public transit, and safe bike and pedestrian paths. Nearly half of Minnesota's roads and bridges are more than 50 years old and in dangerous condition, making it more difficult to move people and goods and services to their next destination. Only 10% of jobs in the metro area are easy to get to by transit, and bus service is very limited in greater Minnesota. A safe, efficient, stable transportation and transit system is necessary for workers to get to work and children to get to school. New long-term revenue is needed to generate new economic development opportunities throughout the state, help retain and attract a talented workforce, create jobs, and keep Minnesota economically competitive. Please support the comprehensive transportation funding in House File 1555. Thank you.
Thank you. Jessica Lake and then Bentley Graves. On deck.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Jessica Lake. I'm here representing myself as just a transportation user. I've been fortunate enough to have been employed by two big companies that are located in downtown Minneapolis. I spent over 11 years with Target Corporation, and I'm currently employed by Thrivent Financial. Both companies participate in the MetroPass program. Thrivent, my current employer, subsidizes a part of that MetroPass, which makes it taking mass transit an easy choice for me when deciding how I will get to and from work. My husband and I moved to Ramsey, Minnesota last summer. When we were looking for homes, it was a top priority for us to find a home that was within 5 to 10 minutes of transit options. We truly lucked out when we found a home that was less than 5 minutes from the Ramsey North Star Station. I've always been an avid bus rider my whole career in working in downtown Minneapolis. It's a stress-free way for me to get to and from work. The bus times were frequent and usually had midday options, which made getting home easier if something popped up. I've been taking the North Star train for the past 9 months, and I must admit, I'm an even bigger fan of taking the train. The train is clean, comfortable, and consistently on time. An hour of my day is spent on the train, and most days I actually choose to work. My only feedback is I wish the North Star offered a few midday routes. Public transportation and programs like the MetroPass make taking mass transit an easy and affordable choice. The stress of a commute of having to endure traffic, construction, and weather is removed. With the hustle and bustle of our busy lives, I truly feel like I am given the gift of time when choosing to take public transportation. My experience with transit is not unique. Many of my colleagues at work use transit to commute. In addition to being less stressful, it is less expensive than maintaining a car and parking in a ramp downtown. It also takes a lot of drivers off of the highways, which benefits everyone who is trying to get to work. We can see the population growth that is occurring where we live in Ramsey. With the metro area expected to add hundreds of thousands of people over the next 2 decades, the state needs to invest in transit so we can grow and thrive. I support the metro sales tax and other funding proposed in this bill to ensure that we have the transit system that works for everybody in our region. Those dollars will provide a great return on investment for the Twin Cities and our entire state. Thank you for the opportunity to share my thoughts.
Thank you very much. Bentley Graves. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Bentley Graves from the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. The Minnesota Chamber of Commerce supports a safe, reliable, efficient, and multimodal transportation system in Minnesota to ensure businesses are able to get their goods to market and their customers' employees to their door. We agree that additional investment is needed to improve the state's transportation system, and in 2017, we made important progress on this investment, working alongside Governor Dayton, the legislature, and other stakeholders. In the current biennium, funding for transportation has increased at a rate of just over $100 million per year. That's equal to about a 3-cent gas tax increase. Starting on July 1 of this year, when the new biennium begins, that will increase to a rate of more than $200 million per year, equal to about a 6 to 7 cent gas tax increase. These sizable funding increases are already on the books. Increased investment is happening. And while we appreciate the efforts in this bill to bring more resources in the system, we cannot support it. The gas tax is one of the few state-imposed taxes where Minnesota is competitive nationally. This bill would raise it to one of the highest in the nation, joining a list of many other business taxes where we are already a national outlier. And this proposed gas tax increase sits alongside a House tax bill that will push some of these very same taxes higher still. Employers don't have the luxury of looking at these and other proposed tax increases in a vacuum. Before we consider raising a tax like the gas tax, where Minnesota is competitive nationally, we need to make progress in bringing down some of the other business taxes that already put us at the top of national rankings. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. Is there anyone else in the audience that would like to testify on House File 1555? All right, members, Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I do want to just remind people that Amber Backus did leave a note here from the Minnesota Auto Dealers Association voicing her opposition to this bill for the reasons that are listed there. But as I start, I would like to make sure that everybody understands that I don't think anyone around this table would disagree in our need for funding this infrastructure, and even the amount of need that is necessary. But I do think that we have real differences in how we go about that, and I think that's worthy for us to debate. And so when we talk about this or that, please understand that we don't disagree with the need for funding those, just in how we do that. And with that, Mr. Chair, and to Chair Hornstein, I do commend you on a really difficult task that was laid in front of you with, first of all, a negative target, and then with the priorities that you prefer to put into the bill. It was a real challenge, and I think you did what you wanted to and what you needed to do with that. But the way I look at this bill, I really think this bill is driving Minnesota in reverse. I think it is going backwards in a lot of things. I think it is touted as being a very progressive transportation bill, but it's on the backs of a very regressive tax structure, which I think is a different direction than what we really want to go. Once we remove the $418 million that the current budget puts in as dedicated transportation funding and removes that, it becomes very difficult for us to maintain moving forward without regressive taxes to fill that. And that's to me a very big challenge. We have $32 million taken directly out of transportation and put in a general fund that most people would thought that was going to transportation, and that has to do with the vehicle lease sales tax. And then when we redistribute those funds from 60% to 40%, which, by the way, the constitutional amendment was worded uniquely, in which it says no less than 40% goes to transit and no more than 60% goes to highway user distribution fund. Even increasing that fund, the tax rate to 6.875%, the highway user tax distribution fund is actually getting about $7 million less than if we had kept under the same proposal. So we're reducing the dollars going into the highway user tax distribution fund. Now, I know we're compensating for that with this regressive 70% increase in gasoline taxes, but it still is a departure from where we're going. And so I'm very concerned about that. We heard from Mr. Chair Hornstein that he believes the gas tax really needs to go towards road and bridge infrastructure only. That was a comment that he made. And yet in his bill, we have $1 million going out of the HUTD, which is funded by the gas tax, going to a study that is not going towards roads and bridges. It's going for a study on how we fund how we use our tax distribution. Now, that's critical because that $1 million is taken off the top before it gets distributed to counties and municipalities and even to our trunk highway bridges. So that is reduced, and so the amount to everybody else will also be reduced. I do have one question for the chair, if possible. Earlier today, we had a discussion about how the other side determined how to define the reinsurance program, in which that particular reinsurance program, according to them, was designed so that everybody gets everybody who has insurance got a certain portion of that fund to reduce their payroll, or excuse me, their insurance premium. But the new plan would allow only those at 400% or more getting this reimbursement deduction from theirs, because that was more of a financially responsible and fiduciary responsible area. And so basically, rather than, in their terms, funding the entire industry, they went to individual deductions for those that needed it most. And yet, Mr. Chair, our transit system doesn't use that same model. Instead, we finance through subsidy the entire institution and industry of transit, even though a lot of the high income above that 400% level are going to get the benefit of that reduction. So do you see that as a contradiction, or do you see that there's other benefits as to why we should do it in one area but not in another?
Representative Hornstein.
Mr. Chair, Representative Petersburg, let's keep in mind that the entire transportation system is subsidized in one way or the other. There was an excellent point that the Chair Marquardt and others made earlier about the property tax. That's a subsidy. So I think the sense that, well, some portions are subsidized and some aren't, you know, there is subsidy sprinkled throughout this. What we need to address is what are we getting for that? And what we're getting for that is improvements to a system that is absolutely necessary and vital for our economy, for our prosperity, and our quality of life. And in the transit field in particular, we heard from Ms. Lake from Ramsey, who talked about not only the personal benefits that she and the 40% of the workers in downtown Minneapolis that commute downtown by transit experience in terms of their opportunity costs and convenience. She talked about the opportunity costs and convenience and savings that everybody, road users, drivers, accrue from that, her choice to use transit. So I think it's important to understand that there is subsidization throughout the system, but that we are getting huge returns for the public dollars that we spend. And I thought it was an excellent point as well that was made earlier, you know, concerning the fact that we've had an increase in of something like 40 cents in gas prices over 6 months, and we're not getting any benefit from that. Whereas for this nickel over 4 years, we're getting tremendous benefit.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to Mr. Chair there, you know, and I believe that the health insurance program is getting subsidized all over the place as well. And what you just described is that the subsidy going into transit also benefits those that are above a poverty level or 400% above poverty level. And yet in health insurance premiums, we say, no, we should make a distinction there. That if you're subsidized and you're getting a premium benefit, it's only for those that are under that particular rate. I'm not going to belabor the point. I just wanted to point out the fact that there are some contradictions in how we talk about subsidy and subsidizing, and that we need to at least understand the reasons for them. So my concerns about this bill are many. I think it is, again, as I said before, I think it's driving Minnesota in reverse because we are now taking dedicated funds that we had set aside for transportation, putting them into general fund, which now allows the general fund to fund things that have some waste and abuse into it. And I think that's the wrong direction for us to go. And so I would really oppose this bill and hope others will too, and so we can get back to actually prioritizing all of our state budget for this very important infrastructure, rather than just saying, hey, you can be on autopilot with whatever dedicated funds you can get. I don't think that's in the best interest for our future, and I think it's going to take us backwards. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So being from Wright County, we are an absolute bedroom community. We have the vast majority or the vast number of people in my district are in the trades. They have their own work vans. And, you know, I can go down any of the little towns in my district and, you know, block after block after they get home, I can see their work vans in their driveways. And, you know, for 5 years, I had a company, too, that was a trades company. So these are folks that are not just driving to and from work. They literally have work in their van and they're driving all over the metro. They are heavy, heavy users of fuels. So I wanted to get on the record. We've talked a lot about the 20-cent gas tax, but we've talked very little about the inflator that comes after the 20 cents. So for my constituents back in Wright County that use gas and other fuels tremendously, I want to talk just a little bit about that, and maybe you could enlighten me and tell me just a little bit about the inflator that kicks in 2030 and about how much more percent that would be as it continues to tick along. If you could talk about that just a little bit, and then I have a couple other comments and questions.
Representative Hornstein.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and Representative O'Neill. The gas tax has not kept up with inflation. In fact, it has fallen by not having an index. We have fallen way behind the value that we're getting from the gas tax. So this is simply an effort to keep up with inflation. And we peg it to not to the consumer price index, but to an index that actually reflects the cost of materials. You know, members, these projects don't go away. They just get more expensive. And I have appreciated over the years, Representative O'Neill, the relationship we have forged together with the I-94 Coalition. And I think that's a real good example of why we need to have new revenue in this system. You know, the costs to people along that corridor of waiting in congestion, the amount of gasoline that they're literally wasting just sitting there in traffic, the lack of productivity, the fact that we had a situation not on your part of I-94, but I think closer to the district I represent on I-94, we had 14 cars get flat tires in a matter of minutes because they were running over a pothole. Well, that's hundreds of dollars of expense that those individuals and families could not plan for, but it's coming out of their pocket. And, in fact, the Texas Transportation Institute has said, on average, we pay $1,000 per year because of congestion and because of these unexpected expenses, you know, a front-end alignment, because people are literally running over potholes and driving over very damaged roads. So we need this inflator to keep up with the costs of construction, the spiraling costs of construction. These, again, I will say it again because it's very, very important. These projects don't go away. The I-94 project doesn't go away. I've been on this transportation committee since 2003. The needs we have for Representative Brand on Highway 14, we've made incremental progress, and I'm happy about that. It doesn't go away. It just gets more expensive. And so that, and I think there's another point here in response to your question, Representative O'Neill, that needs to be underlined, especially because I-94 is a corridor of commerce program. Highway 14 has benefited from corridors of commerce. We have $2 billion in this bill for trunk highway bonds. We can't expand that program. We can't fund that program without additional revenue into the system. Imagine it's a credit card that's at its limit. You know, we're not like the federal government. We can't just pass a resolution and raise the debt ceiling. That's irresponsible. That's unconstitutional in the state of Minnesota to budget like that. And I'm glad we don't. But since we don't have that option or shouldn't use that option, let's live within our means. And if we are going to have trunk highway bonding program that's solvent and useful, that can fund these corridors projects, then we need to also have new revenue coming into the system. And so we need to keep up with inflation, Representative O'Neill, and that's why this index is included. Some years it will be applied, and some years it won't. It really is pegged to the cost of constructing highways.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I appreciate all that, and yes, we have worked on the corridors of commerce, and 94 got attention where it wasn't even on the 20-year plan. It wasn't looked at all, and I remember as a freshman, you know, a long time ago, Representative Hornstein, I brought the I-94 coalition in, and they gave their presentation. I remember so clearly what your words were. I never knew there was a problem on I-94. So we went from it being literally non-existent in the legislature here to actually getting shovels in the ground and that being accomplished. And I do appreciate that. But my question was, which I didn't hear an answer to, what is the inflationary rate? And, like, what does that equate to for cents? Because in my notes here, I see that it does not drop below 45 cents per gallon. And is that accurate? Or, you know, I want my constituents to know, not only is this 20 cents a gallon, but where, like, how much does it go up? And is it 1 cent, 2 cent, 5 cent, 10 cent beyond that? I don't know, per year.
So, Mr. Chair and Representative O'Neill, you know, there's an average. You know, my understanding is that it will be about 1 cent, but I'm going to actually have Mr. Lee answer those questions because he's got the numbers and he's pretty familiar with the this National Highway Index that we peg this inflator to. So I will, if it's okay, Mr. Chair, have Mr. Lee assist me on this one.
You got Mr. Lee.
Mr. Chairman, Representative O'Neill, unfortunately, I don't have what the highway cost index is in increase in history, but that's something that I can give the committee. I'll just point you to the substantive language in the bill in front of you. It's on page 34, and the National Highway Construction Cost Index is mentioned on line 34.17. It's my understanding that the National Highway Construction Cost Index has grown slightly faster than the normal measure of inflation, which is the Consumer Price Index. Mm-hmm. So there's a bit of a distinction there, and if I recall correctly, the governor's bill had the Consumer Price Index, and this has the Highway Construction Cost Index. But again, I can get the difference in the history between the two indexes to the committee.
Representative Bornstein.
And thank you. And we, Mr. Chair, we chose this because it accurately reflects the cost of building highways, which is what this goes for. And I believe the latest state to use a gas tax and have an inflator was the state of Alabama, passed through the Republican House, Senate, and signed by the Republican governor. And I believe they used this this as well.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I think it's important, as we have this conversation here on the Tax Committee, that we know exactly what the tax is going forward, not just 20 cents, but in 2023, it's actually indexed inflation beyond that, so it continues to go up. I think the constituents in my district definitely want to know that. I think what else is incredibly important is when Mr. Graves came from the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, and I have to give him a little bit of a shout-out because way back again, when I was a freshman and you were part of this, Representative Hornstein, we worked on efficiency. And I know that at that time the chamber was looking at MnDOT doing a 15% efficiency, and we were able to get a 5% efficiency on the floor as an amendment, and that has actually netted quite a bit in new construction. So I think that's something that I didn't see in this bill, and maybe you could speak to that. But what I wanted to get to is the fact that Mr. Graves had said that now this is yet another area that Minnesota is not business-friendly and not competitive nationally. And so our ranking would move for the gas tax alone, not considering all the other things that are in this bill, but just the gas tax alone, we would rank now at 28, we'd go to fourth. And this is my first year on the Tax Committee, and I can't believe how many times I have heard one bill after another, saying that Minnesota will now rank first or second highest in the nation in tax. And here's yet another example of us moving from the 28th ranking to the fourth. And so that's concerning to me, particularly when we talk about an inflator at the end of all of that. So it's not just 20 cents, folks. It's 20 cents plus the inflator every year thereafter. But it also, something else that we haven't really talked a whole lot about is not just the gas tax, but all the other fuels that are involved. And so we're talking about E85, which makes sense, but M85, we're talking about liquefied petroleum or propane. We're talking about liquefied natural gas, compressed natural gas, and just some of the, you know, for one example, the liquefied natural gas is going from 15 cents to 27 cents. So all across the board, we're raising tax on not just gasoline, but all of these other fuels in addition to that. And I don't know, maybe the chamber has an idea of what does that do to our ranking, because he only talked about the gas tax, but these are, you know, every fuel out there. I mean, it's liquefied petroleum, propane, liquefied natural gas, of course E85, but they're all going up. They're all going up. So I think that the public needs to be aware of that also. So everything is going up. I had heard one member say, from the moment you buy your vehicle until you retire it, there is an additional cost to having that all the way through until that car goes to the scrapyard. So I think it's important for Minnesota to know that, and particularly Wright County, where I have a very, very high number of commuters, and it's a bedroom community, and also a whole bunch of, you know, union trades guys out there that have their own trucks, and they're going all over the place, and they are using and consuming a lot of fuel. And the other thing I want to say before I let some other members speak is the fact that when we're increasing all of these fuels, we are also that is a cost to business, and they will pass that cost along. And so that is why this is a really, really, really hard tax to increase for those that are on fixed incomes. And my seniors are not happy. The low income and the seniors are also not happy, and so the cost of bread is going to go up. The cost of bananas are going to go up. Everything is going to go up because how does it get to us? It's on a truck, and it's now that tax is going up for that fuel. So I think Minnesota needs to understand how much this impacts their everyday lives, and everything that they purchase that has been trucked in here will also go up. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Joaquin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just looking up some facts just so I could kind of get a clear picture when we talk about competitiveness. A lot of states are running into what we're running into and making sure that our roads are maintained, because it kind of is a crisis across the state. And since 2013, 31 states have increased their gas tax because they understand it takes money to build things. 22 states have some sort of variable rate, some of which is indexed to inflation that goes up and down with costs. And we talked a little bit, or we heard a little bit today about the investment we made in the last year in our roads, and that investment was a shift. It was a shift out of our general fund, and it was only for a year. That wasn't new money. That was a shift, and that left a hole, along with a lot of other things that we fund, including education and health care. So I really do appreciate, especially Mr. Wuerlich, bringing some practical views here to this conversation and kind of hearing what my parents taught me, which is we get what we pay for. You know, it's been a bipartisan approach the last few years to realize how much this is going to cost, the cost that we have out there, the cost that we have out there for folks that are breaking axles and have hopping their tires, and folks get that. They get sitting in gridlock away from their time at work and from their families. And I know those folks that are heavy users that travel for a living, that affects them too. And I would hazard a guess, broken axles, pop tires, time in traffic and congestion cost them a lot more than the small increase of 5 cents in a year that gas tax is going to cost. Because you know what? From morning until night, you can see the gas tax raise 30 cents. And none of that goes to our roads. So I want to just thank Representative Hornstein for bringing this budget forward, sitting on the Transportation Committee. It's an honest budget, and it's a transparent budget. I think Minnesotans get that, because you know what? I think the most of them know you get what you pay for.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think about this gas tax. I think about what it's going to do for people in greater Minnesota, especially where I come from. I come from greater Minnesota as well. Whatever we eat starts out on a field. The first mile of that trip to the market is on a township road. So it's important that this gas tax will increase the amount of township road aid assistance. So Mr. Wuerlich pointed that out. Highway 14 is important to me and to a lot of people in my district. And the important thing to note is this gas tax will increase the transportation trunk highway bonding, which will allow for that road to be improved at some point. This also produces more county aid for the county, state, county roads that are out there. I've got a county road that's underwater right now, County Road 12 in my district. It's going to take money, and money just doesn't grow on trees. And so we have to find a way in order for that money to be provided for that project to be taken care of, so that we've got people in my district that don't have to go 20 or 30 miles out of their way to get to work or to go to the grocery store or to go to the hospital or anywhere else. And so this is important. This provides $300 million for corridors of commerce, which I think is a good program. A couple of years ago, it was tinkered with, and my predecessor, Clark Johnson, stood up on the House floor and talked about how it was a bad idea to tinker with it. And because it was tinkered with, in the last biennium, there was discussion about the corridors of commerce and what it did. And it didn't fit with what the corridors of commerce is built for.
And so I'm hopeful we can have a conversation about corridors of commerce in the future. I think I'm the only one this year that actually brought a bill forward to actually look at fixing corridors of commerce. And so I'm hopeful that we can have a conversation about that. Anybody else that wants to talk to me afterwards, we can have a chat in my office. Minnesota Transportation Alliance sent a letter to all the representatives and senators. If you open up the letter, it showed that there was over $1 billion worth of requests for transportation this year. All the different bills, like my $85 million for Highway 14, all of them added up as over $1 billion. We're not going to get there if we don't start talking about how we're going to fund those roads and those bridges and those overpasses for those train tracks. If it comes down to schools or roads, I think this is a better approach because it doesn't take $450 million from schools or health care or all of the other things in the budget. So that's another reason I support it. And another thing I keep coming back to, a D+. In my district, I'd say Highway 14 is an F. And there are other roads across the state, probably you have them in your district too, that are Fs as well. And so how does that compete on the national scale when we've got D+ or F roads? We talk about, you know, the regressive nature of this bill. We talk about the regressive nature of the gas tax. I just keep coming back to, and I want to thank you, Chair Hornstein, for having a field hearing in Mankato, where we talk to people in my district in particular about the dangers of traveling on Highway 14. We talk to people who survived car crashes. We talk to people who lost loved ones on Highway 14. And I keep coming back to that conversation in which Iona Reinhardt talked about losing her son, Michael, not more than a year ago this week on Highway 14, because he was in the wrong place at the wrong time. And I think that's regressive any time we lose a life on a highway. We can actually do something, and at the legislature, we can actually lead, and we can actually do something to improve people's livelihoods, to improve people's quality of lives in greater Minnesota. So thank you, and I support this. That's why. Thank you.
Representative Swiecinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just, you know, I want to kind of piggyback on what Representative O'Neill was talking about with that potential inflator, and just kind of a, just so folks can get a better handle on it and what that would potentially mean, I would just ask staff and maybe the commissioner, since you're up there, to just, if you, let's just imagine 5 years ago that inflator went into place and give us the numbers what it would be over the last 5 years so that we can kind of have more of a concrete, you know, if that was in place and we looked at that kind of inflationary index, just so we could kind of get a real look at what that would mean. I'd appreciate that, so.
Mr. Chair.
Commissioner.
Thank you. Representative Swiecinski, we've actually done that. And one of the things that was interesting to me that is in 2008 had the original transportation package actually had a CPI inflation index on it. The governor has the CPI inflation index. That's about a penny point three per year or so thereabouts. It could also go down. It also may not go on in a year, depending on what inflation is. I know that Chair Hornstein has a different calculator in his bill. But what I can tell you is if in 2008 that inflation index was on the gas tax when we raised it 8.5 cents, you wouldn't be sitting here today discussing this bill because it would have gone up about 20 cents. And that would have relieved this legislature from actually having to have this sort of debate. And we would have been able to, although I want to thank Representative Torkelson and Representative Petersburg and all those members who worked hard at getting more funding into transportation in the last few years, because it was the only way you could agree on doing it, which was to take it out of the general fund. Mr. Chair and Representative Swiecinski, this has been the tried and true way to fund transportation in our state over the last at least 5 to 6 decades, and that is dedicated transportation funding guaranteed by the state constitution. Members, not every penny raised in this country is the same on gas tax, and that's the other point I'd like to make to you. You will hear that Ohio just raised their gas tax 10.5 cents, and they did that bipartisanly. But do you know that in Ohio, that raises 1 penny, raises $66 million. In Minnesota, one penny will raise $31 million. In Texas, one penny will raise $174 million. Yes, I believe that there is a consequence to doing this, but that's why the governor recognized the Working Family Credit as the way to help poor Minnesotans be able to relieve their burden. Members, I can't speak strongly enough. We have 500 projects that will be funded with this funding over the next 10 years. 500 projects that will not move forward in the same way without new funding. So, Representative Swierczynski, I thank you for the question, Mr. Chair, to be able to answer it, to tell you that in 2008, had we kept and not had to negotiate a final deal that did not include inflation, we would not be having this discussion today because these projects would be funded.
Representative Swierczynski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just, you know, that's a great point, Madam Commissioner. We're talking about, you know, general fund dollars being stripped out of the bill moving forward, and yet we're using general fund dollars to backfill, because we don't want to use general fund dollars to backfill using the Working Family Credit the damage it's going to cause onto these families. So while we're saying we don't want general fund dollars because of this tax, it's essentially that's what we're doing. We're just taking general fund dollars that we're going to transportation and saying we're going to put a sales tax increase on it, and then we're taking general fund dollars and putting them in a different part of the budget to make up for it. So, you know, I think from a funding mechanism standpoint, I'm glad the governor does realize and recognize that it is going to hurt families of low income in rural Minnesota and all over the state. But in reality, we're simply taking general fund dollars out of transportation and putting them into other parts of the budget to make up for a tax increase. And, you know, I personally believe, you know, I think we also pay local units of government also pay sales tax. A lot, I think, up to between the $50 to $60 million a year on road projects. So we're taking dedicated funding, and then those units of government, when they are given state dollars, and then you turn around and use a lump sum contract and buy those materials, are paying sales tax, and that's going back into the general fund. So there is a lot of work that we can do. I appreciate the work that we did in the last budget to do specific projects across the state using general fund dollars, and you know, there's a lot of other things in this bill that are very troublesome. I mean, I just look at House File 1146, Representative Dean's bill, looking at the per-mile driving pilot project. You know, those are different ways to say, well, is folks going to come back and say, well, this still isn't enough? Well, I think we see, you know, as we look at the map of what is going to happen, when the day comes and say, well, this isn't going to be enough, we passed this in 2019, I think we see what the roadmap does lay before us is as vehicles get better and better gas mileage and use less and less gas, which is most studies say that's what will be the direction, that we're going to look at other unique ways to fund transportation. And so folks we say this is going to be all get all, but I think there's going to be more bites out of the apple, and the bite's going to be coming out of local folks' pocketbook. So,
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just want to comment on a couple more statistical pieces, and I think the commissioner talked about it's absolutely true. Other states raise more dollars per cent of gas tax, but that's immaterial because that's not comparing apples to apples. I mean, the real deal is what is the impact of that cent tax on the average person? And so let's just talk about that $31 million. I think it's actually a little over $31 million, but let's use $31 million per cent of gas tax, and let's assume that we're at $30 million if we take away the amount of impact that that gas tax is based upon people driving through the state that aren't residents. 20 cents times $30 million is $600 million per year. How many people do we have in Minnesota? 5.5 million people. That's $109 for every man, woman, and child as a cost for that a gas tax increase. 5.5 million people paying $109 per capita per year. Now, you could say, well, some people aren't going to be driving, so they're not going to pay that gas tax. And no, it may not be direct, but it's going to be indirect. Somehow, somewhere, it's going to be passed on to the average individual. And earlier we heard about somebody saying, you know, I've got, I talk to people that are paying $100 a month for bus fare, traveling back and forth. And you know what? People down in my area would love their transportation cost to only be $100 a month. We can't even pay the amount of gas that we have put in the car at that price. So I think we have to be real careful about comparing one state to the other. I know that Texas is a whole lot more than 10 times the state population, and yet their gas tax that they are raising is only about 4 or 5 times what we have here in the state. So let's just keep that in mind. But even if we could convince people that we need to raise gas taxes, the complaint that I have down in my area is they don't have trust that it's going to go to roads and bridges. Mm. They just don't have that trust. They believe it's going to be siphoned off. It's going to be leaked. And even in the spreadsheet that was handed out today, line 24 has trunk highway operating pressure coming out of trunk highways going into aeronautics. And we have a statewide radio where it says trunk highway pressure coming out of trunk highway. That's $446,000. That's $500,000 right there that's coming directly out of trunk highways. We have the $1 million that Representative Straczynski talked about, that study coming directly out of the HUTD, which is prior to it getting distributed to the trunk highway fund. So there are those issues out there, and we need to clean those up as well, and we'll find that we have quite a lot more dollars. So there are a lot of concerns with this bill, and I think we need to be helpful to the average public out there and actually understand how much it's costing them for this roads and bridges. It's not just the 20 cents that they see in the gas tax pump. It's the increases that make up the other $80 that they're going to be paying for other costs in regards to transportation and funding. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Commissioner Anderson Kelleher, on the formula, how does that work?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And first of all, I just want to say I brought up the value of dollars raised because the arguments being made before you that this is going to affect business competitiveness. I don't know that anyone has actually produced a study that shows us it actually does that, because members, in 2008, I joined with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce when we raised the gas tax. They were at the table. They shaped the bill. That was never an argument made. So I'm just going to say, you know, show me that study. People, I believe, are living here in Minnesota. They live in Ohio. I do not know of businesses rushing out of Ohio to leave right now because the gas tax is going up by 10.5 cents. But to the issue of this, so I'm never going to say the word again in public, this so-called place where money goes that's not to our roads and bridges. There is case law in Minnesota, 1947, 1951, that says anything that goes to the maintenance, to the building, and to the maintaining of our trunk highway system, therefore, can come from the constitutionally dedicated funds of Article 14. And what does that mean? It means that is why you see state troopers paid for out of the trunk highway fund. Their job is absolutely integral to making sure our roads and bridges are safe. But I would argue on the issue of operating pressure and what we're seeing there, Representative Petersburg and Mr. Chair, has to do with when you go into a Target store sometime in the next month, and you go and you put in your basket some item, there is a lot that has gone on behind the scenes to get you that item. Target has attributed to the cost of those goods all sorts of things that go into buying the goods, whether it's the transport of those goods, the wholesale buying of those goods if they didn't manufacture them themselves. It has to do with the people who are in the aisles and the red shirts helping you. It has to do when you go to the checkout system and the technology that they have had to invest in. And Representative Petersburg, when you drive on a road or bridge in Minnesota delivered by a county or the state, there is a lot that has gone on to make sure that the planning, design, the hiring of the contracting firm is right on so that you can get on that road and know, and your constituents can know, they can drive safely. So this is not, the delivery of these projects is wrapped up in us making sure that we can both hire, design, work with the right private contractors to be able to deliver these projects. And that's a lot of what happens when people are talking about this, I'm going to call it really what is not true. This is about delivering the system that you all would like to have in those 500 projects.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner, let's just get back to the very first topic that I brought up, trunk highway pressure and aeronautics. Where does that fit in those three categories that you said was constitutionally, according to the Supreme Court, said it appreciates?
Commissioner.
So, Mr. Chair, and Representative Petersburg, and our budget analyst is going to come up, our budget director is going to come up for you, too. The history of this is that the Department of Transportation actually runs and maintains a full multimodal system in the state of Minnesota. And I believe it's a $2 million increase to aeronautics in this budget. Yes.
So if you'd introduce yourself.
Mr. Chair, members, for the record, my name is Josh Knattard-Hubinger. I am the budget director at MnDOT. I will respond directly to the question about operating pressures. That, if you look at the tracking sheet, is sprinkled throughout all the different budget activities. That reflects pressures to compensation costs going up, to commodities in some cases. And so every budget activity that is funded with base budgets in our current budget bill is proposed to get a relatively modest increase. It works out to be about 3% for those different factors. And so the aeronautics portion is specific to, we maintain a fleet of planes at MnDOT that flies MnDOT employees as well as others. The trunk highway portion is to pay for the pilots and trunk highway funded employees to travel around the state.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay, if you look at the spreadsheet that I'm sure that you guys put together, right?
Well, I think this spreadsheet would, I mean, would this be the...
But you've seen it, right? You understand that the rest of the base budget comes out of the aeronautics fund. It doesn't come out of trunk highway funds. But you're taking the pressure for the increases in those funds not out of those budget areas, but out of trunk highway directly, which is contrary to what you just said. And so I understand that they could be used, but I also know that aeronautic fund gets charged back to the trunk highway fund for the use of those funds as well. So to me, that is... That doesn't fit within the maintaining quality, whatever, of all the services directly related to roads and bridges.
So, Mr. Chair, maybe I can try one more time. So what it means is that when one of our MnDOT employees needs to fly to northwestern Minnesota, because we have calculated that it's actually cheaper for them to fly than to get in a car or have three people get in a car and reimburse or use the vehicle fleet we have, what's happening there is for the portion of their salary that is related to the trunk highway fund, we are then able in MnDOT to put that back into the aeronautics budget. We use a series of chargebacks, like many state agencies do, to each individual fund. That is what's happening there. So it is about the delivery of the trunk highway system. It is about the maintenance of the trunk highway system. It is not about the overall aeronautics division. It's about who is using the aeronautics division and how we're getting those dollars out there. And members, Mr. Chair, one of the other issues for this operating piece is actually, I believe what, I wasn't here, I wasn't the commissioner when this happened, but apparently there is a decrease that MnDOT would experience in our budget in relation to the operating pressures that are unique to MnDOT, and that is also why you're seeing that.
Representative Petersburg.
I will just I'm not going to go in further debate with it, but I think you can understand the public's perception about how this doesn't seem appropriate. And we're dealing with perceptions, and we're dealing with people that are going to have to accept a gas tax increase so that we can pay for some of this leakage that's out there. And so I whereas I understand that you can justify it through all sorts of legalities, the reality is that if it doesn't seem right, most people aren't going to think it's right. So I won't debate it any further. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, the weather is not getting any better, and neither are the roads, so I suppose we'll make this brief. What has been said has been said by many of my colleagues. But I just want to share a brief comment and then a question for the author as well. The poll, the recent poll I saw in Minnesota, that most Minnesotans did support, or a good number of them, a 10-cent gas increase if all was dedicated to the roads and bridges. And I think that as this comes to light, and Minnesota's realized that out of the 20-cent gas tax, only 10 will go back to roads and bridges. 3% or 3 cents will go to relieve congestion, which is heavy, especially from coming from Wright County. They'll be very disappointed. Fortunately, this is all dead in the Senate. It's going nowhere. Unfortunately, Representative Hornstein, all the good work that you did in the bill with the increases is probably not going to pass. And Minnesotans are going to have more money in their pocket, I think, at the end of the day, unless you can come to an agreement and a compromise to reduce some of the fees. As I said, most Minnesotans do support, and even in Wright County, a 10-cent increase if it's dedicated to roads and bridges. But there's so many increases in fees and to your bill, to the billions of dollars, that will completely come out of people's pockets and wallets and businesses and families and raise the cost of goods and services that are transported. I think you're making a huge mistake. As far as our trunk highways, there are highways, Highway 14, Highway 12, and others, particularly 12 and 14, they're very dangerous. Commissioner, you know that. We've dealt with some issues with that. And I would like to see a good portion of the money at least dedicated to making highway traffic safety. And your bill does some of that, but it doesn't go far enough to even save lives. You're spending millions of dollars on a climate and environment report annually. It was $75,000 each year for a climate and environment report. I don't think that's going to go towards highways at all and for the safety or to relieve congestion or to fill potholes. So I'm disappointed to see that. I hope that can come out in the Senate. $1 million from the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund to create a pilot project to test a mile charging system for drivers. I presume for an electric car, where nowhere in your bill does the electric drivers pay anything for our roads and bridges. There's no increase to their fee for gas taxes, except when they purchase the vehicle. Then you have another $122,000 from the general fund for the active transportation program to encourage and fund bike pedestrian infrastructure. So I won't go on and on with the different fees and structures that will go in here that are not going to go to relieve congestion. They're not going to go to improve our trunk highway fees. They're not going to go towards improving the safety of our roads. They'll just go towards taking more money out of the families and businesses in Minnesota and not get to really where we need to do and relieve congestion, fix our highway system. And very disappointed in that. As you said, it's user fees, Commissioner and Representative Hornstein. Yet on your on the bill on 27.9 down to 27.20 for the appreciation of a vehicle, by the 11th year of a vehicle, those users pay a reduction. So you're not utilizing most of the cars in Minnesota that are 11 years or older. Their fee will be reduced. Therefore, not a user fee. Why is that?
Commissioner.
So, Mr. Chair, Representative McDonald, the 20 cents raised by this bill, a nickel every year for 4 years in Representative Hornstein's proposal, will go 100% by Constitution to roads and bridges. I think that members sometimes are confusing the return to the general fund of general fund statutorily dedicated dollars. Every single penny of that gas tax, or we will be sued, will go to roads and bridges. And Mr. Chair and Representative McDonald, I can't tell you. At MnDOT, the employees and folks at MnDOT, from top to bottom, we have a safety culture. our number one job is to work to get you from where you want to go to where you want to be safely. And so to say that the 500 projects that will be funded with this funding will not improve the safety of Minnesotans is almost unspeakable. It absolutely will improve the safety of our roads and bridges. That is our ethic. That is our mission. We will assure you of that. That is what we do.
Representative McDonald.
Commissioner, I know that is the number one priority of MnDOT. And I did not say that it wouldn't be their number one priority, continue to be. I stated three items, particularly in the bill, that are going towards items that will not improve the safety of the road. So I brought that out as the attention to illustrate to you that not every fee, not every increase, not every gas tax increase will be going towards the safety and improvement of our highway system. And those three items that I chose, the $1 million a year for a project to test a per mile charging system for driving, or $122,000 for an active transportation program to encourage people to bike and pedestrian. Those two items particularly, and I could go on for several other, are not going to be helping increase the safety of our highways. Wouldn't you agree?
So, Mr. Chair and Representative McDonald, I would disagree about bike and pedestrian safety. We are in a near epidemic today of pedestrian fatalities in Minnesota, and it goes across the state. So any time that we can work with local communities and counties to do better design and safety work on a mode of transportation that many Minnesotans must use, which is their feet, the oldest form of transportation that we have, the footpath, or on biking, which is increasing and across the state, the number of people who want to be biking. I think it's important. But let me get to your vehicle miles traveled issue. This is actually to match a federal grant that we have. And to this point, sometimes you will hear in the debate, and I'm sure you'll hear it on the House floor, that we should not be relying on the fuel tax, gas tax, or any of these other things, because the future is coming and no one will be filling up their car anymore. I disagree. From the information that I have seen, it is the workhorse of our system today, the gas tax. But you do need to know, and I think it's fair to say, that of the $4.9 million vehicles registered in Minnesota today, under 4,000 of them are fully electric today. But we do need to get ready for the future, Representative McDonald. And I think that is exactly what this sort of study helps us do, is to be able to analyze and look at how are we going to fund transportation and how will Minnesotans be traveling and interacting 25 years from now. Not today, but 25 years from now or 30 years from now. And these very small amounts of money, and Representative Hornstein certainly can talk to them, the issues that we hear from Minnesotans about are they are worried not only about their personal safety on our roads and bridges, but they are concerned about the effect that climate has through transportation on their lives, on the lives of their children and grandchildren, and even unimagined great-grandchildren. And so I just urge us to look at the whole here. It is easy to see fault. The fault finder, not you, of course, can always find fault. The perfect is the enemy of the good. This is more than a good bill that Representative Hornstein and his committee have assembled.
Representative McDonald. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll try to be real quick. I know that people are anxious to get out in the storm. I can tell you that all the members of the Highway 310 Coalition, just real quickly, Representative Hornstein, you mentioned Alabama some time ago, and I just want to give the members a little perspective. Alabama did raise their gas tax, and so now their gas tax is at 31 cents. And the average of their neighboring states, okay, states that immediately touch them, is 28.5 cents. In Minnesota, of course, if we go to 48.5 cents over the next 4 years, the average of our neighboring states, the average of our neighboring states is going to be 28.5 cents, and the average of the Alabama's neighboring states is 31 cents as I look at this. In terms of total tax burden, Minnesota currently is number 5, and Alabama is number 43. So that's just to give a little perspective. The other thing I wanted to do is, Commissioner, you said something about business competitiveness. Yesterday I received an email, I'm not going to say the person's name, referring to the gas tax. Looks like it's time to move our companies out of Minnesota. Taxes are driving my companies to cross the border and establish in Sioux Falls or Hudson. Nevertheless, enough is enough. This amount of rise, referencing the gas tax, will be the last straw for our 40-plus-year-old Minnesota companies. If this huge tax is implemented, the team will be assembled and a new location will be picked by summer's end, doing whatever we can to get our companies and their jobs out of Minnesota by the end of the year. I'd be happy to share the person with you offline, but members, this is real, and when you live in a border community like I do, kind of, or at least the district that I represent, this is an amazingly regressive tax, and I've talked to several small service station operators in the cities like Carlstead and so forth who are very, very fearful of what impact this is going to have on their business. Thank you.
Very good. Did you want to respond to that?
Well, I can respond quickly. A couple of points. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Representative Fabian. We do have there is a provision in the existing law related to border communities, and we don't change that. Because we're sensitive to the question that you brought up. And I can address the small service operations. It sounds like you wanted to respond, so, Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Hornstein, I appreciate the border cities legislation that's in place, but all that does is move the border further east, because at some point, when you move the border further east from the Red River, now the service station operators and the people and so forth who live in Hawley or some other small community, I mean, at some point it's going to impact people. So I understand the immediacy of East Grand Forks and Moorhead and Breckenridge and the other cities that are in that border cities. But what about the cities that are just outside of that border cities legislation area? That's a reality.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Hornstein.
Just quickly, and I think that Representative Fabian made an important point about small service station operators, and it's an opportunity for me to, reiterate again a point about the fact that we've had a 40, in some cases 60 cent increase in the per gallon cost of gas. Oh, just over the last few months. We're not talking about a nickel over 4 years. We're talking about a 22% increase just in a matter of months. And it's important to know where is that money going? 65% of it, goes directly to oil companies and these Wall Street speculators and others that are, involved in the oil, the complex speculative oil price economy. 14% goes to refiners. 13% taxes, 8% marketing and distribution. And then a small percentage of that 8% is to the folks that Representative Fabian is talking about. So where's the outrage, members? Where's the outrage at this 65 cents that is going to folks that have already received a $25 billion reward in the federal tax bill, directly to big oil? Where's the outrage about the incredible speculation that is involved in this industry, the different exchanges, the Dubai Exchange, the London Exchange, the New York Mercantile Exchange, people buying and selling? This isn't production. This isn't money going to fill potholes in our streets and in our communities, which is really what our 5 cent increase over 4 years goes to. And look, that's a reality. We may not have a lot of control over that in the Minnesota House of Representatives. But I want to know, where's the outrage about that? That's where most of this money is going. So let's get some perspective here. And let's understand that this nickel over 4 years is going directly to our communities. We will have for you, and I think many of you have seen this already, the illustrative maps of everybody's district about what you are going to get in your community as a result of the passage of this bill. So I think it's really important. I share your concern. And you know, members, we had more than one person lobby us about getting rid of the minimum markup. Maybe if you get rid of the minimum markup, that'll reduce the cost of gas. Well, the minimum markup was Representative David's effort in 2001 to protect the very people you're talking about. And I said, no, we are not. We have to make sure that the pressures that are put on these small retailers, we understand those and respect those, and we're not going to mess with the minimum markup. So I just wanted to give people some perspective about where that dollar that you're paying at the gas pump goes, because it's very important. People have to get some perspective on this.
Representative Hornstein, that sounded like a great closing statement. Would you like to add any more? And I think anything further, Representative Hornstein, that sounded like...
Well, I just really appreciate, Mr. Chair, the members' comments on both sides of the aisle. I'll just go back to my opening comment to say that this is a much-needed, urgent bill that will fix our infrastructure, that will make our state competitive and economically prosperous, because we can't have a strong economy and create jobs without a first-rate infrastructure. We can do better than a D+. Please vote yes.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Commissioner. The chair renews his motion to refer House File 1555 to the general register. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay.
Nay.
Motion does prevail, and House File 1555 on the general register.
You should vote in.
Members, this is our, may not be our last meeting, but last one unless other bills come forward. So thank you so much. Again, thank you to staff, and have a safe break and safe travels home, and thank you so much. We are adjourned.